Okay, one surprise after the next, Scott. Okay, before we start, after this amazing evening in Qashqai's, I want to give the floor immediately to Mrs. Kasimati. The floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. President. Dear colleagues, good morning to all. I would like to share with you today in this Parliament and within the context of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, in which we are members and we're today here in process, to share with you the commemoration of the 5 years today from the killing of Pavlos Fissas by the neo-Nazi group political party Golden Dawn in Greece. Pavlos Fissas was an anti-fascist artist and a worker, having been born and living in the second district of Piraeus, where I am elected, and I knew him as well as his family. And his killing was the start of the criminal proceedings for the Golden Dawn. I believe that that the Council of Europe should proclaim that 18th of September 2013 and every 18th of September as a European Day of Remembrance and fight against neo-Nazism, and in honor of all the victims, so as these incidents won't happen again and will not face the face of humanity. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your wording. And I think the party, the golden, what you say in Greek?
Huh? Golden Dawn.
Golden Dawn is a shame of for your country. It's a shame for Europe that such parties are existing. I lost any words, and we know what they did. Hunting of immigrants. They killed migrants. Your proposal, we can carry to the Bureau. It's not the possibility of the decision of a committee, but the applauses of all of us shows that we are on your side, and I think this is a very interesting initiative. Thank you very much. Now, for the next item, it's nuclear safety and security in Europe. We invited the Minister for Environment of Portugal, Mr. Matos Fernandes, but in the last minute, some important things allowed him not to come now. So today we have to vote for the draft resolution, and I want to give now Mrs. Günay the floor to present in some words, because we discussed in different meetings this important draft resolution, and the good news is this draft resolution is in the October plenary session, and it was an urgent wish of all the Baltic colleagues that it is not on Friday. It moved ahead, and so, as I know now, a lot of colleagues of the Assembly will participate in this debate. Mrs. Günay, you have the floor now.
Thank you, Chair. Dear Chair and dear members, Nuclear energy has been one of the primary sources for energy in Europe for decades. Its safety and security is of primary importance since nuclear energy does not concern only Europeans living near production sites, but also Europeans in neighboring countries. Therefore, the issue of nuclear energy is deservedly a priority topic for this committee. The scope of my report aims at taking stock of the current conditions as well as offer suggestions for improvements. These improvements will contribute to ensuring that European nuclear energy sector is in compliance with the international standards. As members of this committee, it is our duty to exert effort towards implementation of these suggestions through legislative initiatives. As the rapporteur, my approach to this highly critical issue was to address it in a fact-based and neutral manner rather than preparing a report that will be for or against nuclear energy. I believe such an approach paved the way for a report which considered the nuclear safety and security in a holistic and impartial way. To that end, we have held many hearings and listened to the representatives of the European Commission, Foratom and its ENIS program, Greenpeace, and experts from the Lithuania and Belarus concerning the Ostrovets plan, and their expertise and views have enriched this report. I also carried out a fact-finding mission to the NEA in Paris and have used information provided on the website of International Atomic Energy Agency. The draft resolution and explanatory memorandum inter alia aims at improving nuclear safety and security in Europe, informing local population and bolstering international cooperation in this field. I believe these suggestions could provide a solid basis for further enhancing international rules and norms in this field to offer a safe and secure nuclear energy for all Europeans. As the member of the PACE and elected representatives, our duty is to ascertain whether the European nuclear sector is up to international and European standards. I would like to highlight a couple of points that we have driven from the expert views and reports. First of all, it's a fact that there are 184 reactors operating in the European countries, keeping in mind that the operational lifetime of a nuclear power plant extends to between 40 and 60 years. In Europe, 82 reactors are older than 35 years. In addition, 29 units are older than 40 years, raising the probability of a serious accidents higher. So the frequency of safety assessment should be increased for the reactors older than 40 years. Secondly, there exists no specific common international legislation on nuclear safety and security, which is binding for all countries. For nuclear safety, the EU directives are binding for the member states. In addition, the IAEA's standards just serve as general benchmark but covers all the European countries. However, regarding the nuclear security, there is no binding legislation for the countries. It is handled at the national level. Thirdly, the cross-border situations at the most conflicting issue among the neighboring countries. If we investigate the current situation of the nuclear power plants in Europe, operating in close proximity to densely populated areas and cities, the outcome is depressive. There are two approaches to define the off-site emerging zones and the distance around the NPPs. The first one is the IAEA's recommendation. The second one is VENRA's recommendation. Based on the IAEA's approach, there are 11 facilities in precautionary action zone, which is defined within 5 kilometers. There are 10 facilities in urgent protective action planning zone, defined between 15 to 31 kilometers. There are 63 facilities in extended planning distance, which covers 100 kilometers area. There are 75 plants in ingestion and commodities planning distance within 300 kilometers. Based on the HERCA and VENRA approach, there exist 11 facilities within 5 kilometer radius. 9 plants are within 20 kilometers. There are 59 facilities up to 100 kilometers. The threat stemming from the proximity issue already exists in Europe. Therefore, in all territories with nuclear installations, local and national authorities should be involved in emergency management planning, while European nations should improve communication and cooperation about nuclear safety and security. I would like to thank my colleagues for the productive debates we have held on this issue and the experts and other relevant parties for their valuable input. I would like to extend my appreciation for the written contributions on the case from Belarusian and Lithuanian authorities. Last but not least, I would also like to thank the Secretary for their diligent work and helping during the writing of this report. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. The first to ask for the floor is John.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, Chair. I want to begin by congratulating the Rapporteur on what's an excellent report, extremely coherent, well-argued, and logical report. It's an extremely good report. It's also an extremely pertinent issue. It's a very real issue. And while there is, as I understand it, and I'm a lay person in these areas, while there is a compelling case for nuclear energy in the context of carbon emissions and in the context of global warming, there are serious problems that need to be dealt with. And I'm going to ask the Rapporteur to comment on a couple of issues specifically. You might comment on the use of nuclear energy and the value it has to deal with carbon emissions, to deal with the global warming. But the real issue, I think, is the dealing with nuclear waste. And that's not been very satisfactorily dealt with. And I'd like to ask you about the dealing with nuclear waste, what steps have been taken, what can be done to create storage, safe storage for nuclear waste. We have an issue, you did mention, and I was very impressed by your report and by your presentation of it, but you did mention the borders issue. And that's really the reason I am duty-bound to get up to speak about this issue. We've had the Sellafield nuclear plant on the western side of the UK, close to the Irish Sea, and there have been dangerous emissions there. There are a number of nuclear plants towards the western side, and we have a worry around nuclear waste there and danger in that sphere. And I would like you to comment on that. And have you specifically, when you did look at borders, did you look at the Irish case and the UK? And basically, if we could get, in my opinion, my humble opinion, that if we could get a storage system for the nuclear waste, it would solve a lot of problems. A satisfactory, cost-effective storage system. And secondly, can I ask you latterly, the last thing, is it the case that there's improved technology now in the nuclear sector and that it's much safer and that it could be entirely safe? It's a very populist thing, and I know you've not been populist in your report, but it's very populist, and sadly populism has taken over Europe at the moment, quite a bit of it anyway. But it's populist to say, oh, all nuclear energy is bad and condemn it out of hand. But we have to shy away from that. We have to look at the question logically. And if we could control the waste and if we could improve the technology, there's a case for it. So I look forward to the responses from our rapporteur. And it's a very real issue in my country, and there is a very real fear of the nuclear emissions into the Irish Sea. And people live in fear of this, and they're reluctant even to eat something like fish because of it. Thank you.
John, you are right. Three Mile Island, Sellafield, that was the big accident before Chernobyl. And Chernobyl was before Fukushima. And this all should remind what is a safety or a clean energy or not. I know in the debate about climate change, there is a misuse of wording that nuclear power is a clean energy, but all the examples you brought on the table tells us it's not a clean energy. Now, Mr. Essel from Austria.
Danke, Herr Vorsitzender. Ich bin dem oder ich stehe diesem Bericht zwiespältig entgegen. Auf der einen Seite sind natürlich Verbesserungen vorgesehen, die man den Mitgliedstaaten vorschlagen wird. Auf der anderen Seite bin ich 100% überzeugt, dass man bei der Atomenergie nicht von einer sicheren Energie sprechen kann. Es sind ja jetzt gerade schon angesprochen worden die Vorfälle Tschernobyl, Fukushima und andere. Also ich glaube, wir verlagern hier die Probleme eher in die Zukunft. Und auch mein Vorredner hat angesprochen, dass wir schließlich und endlich irgendwann ein Endlager für den Atommüll finden müssen. Und das soll sicher sein und nicht über 10 Jahre, nicht über 20 Jahre, sondern über mehrere 100 Jahre und darüber hinaus. Und ich sehe hier wirklich noch keine Lösungsansätze für dieses Problem. Und solange das nicht gegeben ist, lehne ich einmal grundsätzlich die Atomenergie ab. Und man sollte sich in diese Richtung auch in diesem Bericht durchaus äußern, indem man sich mit dieser Frage auch auseinandersetzt.
Maybe you should know that Mr. Essel and I, we are both from Austria. And Austria is the only country who built an atomic power plant station. And after it was finished, we asked the citizens in a referendum, what do you think about that? And with 50.8, I think, the Austrian decided never use atomic energy. Not for peaceful and not for energy. So we put it in the constitution. So for nobody, no minister of Austria is allowed to vote in favor of fighting against risk of atomic energy, because risk is not the question. The principal question is if you use it or use it not. And on international level, we got always the question, why are you against measures to raise up the safety? And we said, no, this is not the question. The only safety power plant station is the zero station and not something else. Okay, now, any other questions? Please, Mr. Oehme.
Danke. Auch ich stehe diesem Bericht sehr zwiespältig gegenüber. Ich möchte es kurz begründen. In dem Bericht wird sehr intensiv eingegangen auf das Kraftwerk, neu zu bauende Kraftwerke in Weißrussland. Aber ich vermisse Reaktionen auf die vielen Kraftwerke, gerade an der deutschen Grenze und an der belgischen Grenze, die tickende Zeitbomben sind. Wir haben beispielsweise die Kraftwerke in Döhl und Tihang, die massive Risse in ihren Reaktordruckbehältern haben. Alleine in Tihang sind es über 34.000 Risse. Und wir können diesen Bericht nicht nur auf die neuen Kraftwerke begrenzen, sondern wir müssen auch die Sicherheit der alten Kraftwerke mit einbeziehen. Danke.
Anybody else? Serhii Kiral.
Thank you. I think it's a very important discussion and debate, and I really appreciate the rapporteur that she is here today with us, and she was able to present the report, and I hope that all the colleagues will support and eventually adopt the report and the draft resolution, because these matters and some of the issues already covered in the report should not go unnoticed. There is a real problem with that particular plant, I don't think the report fully reflects all the issues related, and I don't necessarily agree with all the recommendations put into the draft resolution. For example, we can't really expect Belarus to deliver on any commitments, whether it provide more transparency or access to the facilities, until it's fully integrated within the international bodies, including ours, the Council of Europe, until it starts to cooperate and until it democratizes itself, which is a little bit of the wishful thinking if you look what how things look at the moment. There is another aspect to this particular project, because some colleagues are comparing it with their national situations. Let's do not forget that this is a Russian project. This is the Russia behind this project. Russia was the one picking the location and taking into account the current revisionist and expansionist and aggressiveness of the Russian regime. We should also look and keep in mind that this project could be used as a type of a sort of instrument or tool to influence the European policy, like the Nord Stream 2, for example, the natural gas pipeline. Any problem around the plant will cause enormous difficulties and enormous problems for the neighboring European countries, members of the European Union. It's 40 kilometers to Vilnius. It's located on the main water supply and the river, which flows also through the Lithuanian capital. So all these kind of geopolitical and security issues should be taken into account. And if you refer back to Chernobyl, I should remind you also that one of the problems of Chernobyl was that information was not revealed right after the catastrophe. Nobody knew for weeks what was happening. And that also led to maximizing the impact, the consequences, the health issues, the environmental issues, because there was no proper reaction like it was in Fukushima case or in any other accidents or incidents which are happening in the democracies where there is responsibility and where there is accountability with the people. But at the end, I would support you on this report. Probably there needs to be some amendments to the draft resolution, but we need to move on and do not put this important issue aside. Thank you.
We have a little bit something what we call rien ne va plus in building nuclear power plant station, and there are some companies and states very interested to move on for the next step. And for me, Serhii, it's equal if it's a Western or a Eastern technology. It's at the end, every technology in that way is a high risk in our life. Mr. Masiulis.
Zunächst ich möchte Frau Gyunay bedanken für ihren Rapport. Ich meine, dass wir beginnen mit diesem Rapport neue Mode in Politik. Österreich, wie Sie, Herr Vorsitzender, sagte, schon hat in Verfassung verbotet in Verfassung Atomenergie. In Litauen war auch Referendum, auch ist schon unmöglich Atomenergie entwickeln. Wir hatten in sowjetischen Zeiten ein Atomkraftwerk, aber schon ist geschlossen und ist verboten. Und ich meine, dass solche politische Verständnis muss und weiter verbreitet. Was wir haben, dass schon in diesem Rapport, wenn wir diskutierten über diesen Rapport, wir bemerkten, dass mehrere Atomkraftwerke verschiedene Länder bauen, überall daneben Grenzen. Nicht daneben Hauptstädten, daneben Grenzen. Das heißt, dass solche Verständnis, dass solche Atomkraftwerke sind gefährlich, existiert. Und vielen Dank für Autor dieser Resolution. Alles ist in erster, alles ist gut gemacht. Ja, danke.
Danke, Herr Masiulis. Jetzt sage ich es auf Deutsch. Sie haben völlig recht. Das sieht man von den französischen Atomkraftwerken ab. So befinden sich nahezu alle Atomkraftwerke, wenn man den Atlas in Europa ansieht, immer zu einer Grenze zum nächsten Staat. Egal, ob das in Tschechien, ob das in der Slowakei, ob das in Ungarn ist. Immer ist der nächstliegende Staat nur 20 oder 10 Kilometer oder 15 Kilometer entfernt. Irgendwie muss ja den Betreibern etwas komisch vorkommen, wenn man solche Standorte aussucht. Und wie in dem vorliegenden Fall frage ich mich immer, was geht eigentlich in den Menschen vor, immer auf Erdbebenlinien Atomkraftwerke zu planen? Ich von den existierenden Atomkraftwerken, die wir haben, liegen fast ein Dutzend auf Erdbebenzonen. Und die italienische Bevölkerung zum Beispiel hat der Regierung Berlusconi seinerzeit in einem Referendum die Abfuhr erteilt, dass es ein Atomkraftwerk gibt. Und dann kam Berlusconi auf die Idee, dass Atomkraft machen wir einfach in Albanien und holen den Strom von Albanien herüber, das Risiko trägt Albanien. Das sind ja alles sehr, sehr seltsame Vorkommnisse. Nun, herzlichen Dank für die Diskussion. Nobody ask anymore for the floor. So I come back to Mrs. Güney as rapporteur for some closing remarks.
Thank you for the enlightening comments, and I would like to answer a couple of questions that raised my members. First of all, I would like to highlight that this report is handled in a fact-based and neutral manner. Yes, there are parts that are related to Belarus because the first motion was given by the Lithuanian side, and it was named a potential threat to European countries imposed by the nuclear power plant in Belarus. And as you can understand from this title, this issue has been a source of great concern for people living in the region. So this was the first motion. Then the second motion was given on nuclear security in light of emerging terror threats in Europe. And then these two motions were merged. And the report, as I said before, was handled in a fact-based and neutral manner, as much as we can do. So that's why Belarus is a particular case in this report. But as you all mentioned that this is a general threat, and it is a reality that we have to take into account. Yes, there are positive sides of using nuclear energy, the impact of the carbon emission and the climate change, but there are also negative facts that we have to handle. The first one is the nuclear waste. There were a couple of members mentioned about that. All I can say about the waste management, okay, we have three dimensions of this nuclear energy problem. The first one is related to nuclear safety and security. When we say nuclear safety, it is the safe operation of a nuclear power plant. And nuclear security is the physical protection of the nuclear installations. So the waste management is the third dimension, and it is more technical. And here in this report, it is not the focus of this report. That's all we can say. And in one of the meetings in Paris, we also discussed about this issue, and we decided to focus on nuclear safety and security, not the waste management, because it is a different issue under nuclear energy. And nuclear waste management is implemented under regulation of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it is an unsolved problem, unfortunately. So this report does not cover the waste management of nuclear energy. Yes, there is an improved technology in installing the new nuclear power plants. For example, now BVER 1200 type reactors, they are called the third generation. They are used in Belarus and in the newly constructed plants. It is more safer and the technology is developed. But again, it's a technical issue, and that's all I can share with you right now. Another question. Yeah, the main problem is that Sergey Krell mentioned that we cannot trust the national countries. Yeah, it should be incorporated with the international and European standard or regulations. But unfortunately, there is no common binding legislative for all countries. Maybe we should focus on this too. So we can just recommend and, you know, follow the developments. And I would like to share the map of this. I think we are talking about 184 nuclear power plants in Europe. And I just look at the map and I saw that there are three nuclear power plants at the border of UK close to Ireland. So I think all these nuclear power plants are included in this map. We are talking about 184, so they are all over the Europe. And what else? I think I answered all the questions. Is there anything I missed?
It's okay. Thank you. Then we come for the voting of the draft resolution. First, I have 1, 2, 3, and one amendment from my side. So 4 amendments. I will call the amendments by the specific paragraphs, okay? Paragraph 1. Are there, is anybody against or any abstentions? No. Adopted. Paragraph 2. Any abstentions? Against? No. Unanimously adopted. Paragraph 3. I look around. Nobody against. No abstention. Adopted. Paragraph 4. Ever is in favor, so we can call it as adopted. Paragraph 5, okay, unanimously adopted. Paragraph 6, it's unanimously adopted, thank you. So now we come to paragraph 7. Paragraph 7, I have one amendment by Stella Kyriakides. Stella Kyriakides asked to insert in the first line after the word nuclear facilities a following sentence. I give it immediately to Stella. But I just had the time to read, and I would ask you to propose for your amendment a new paragraph 8, because after nuclear plans of nuclear facilities finished, paragraph 8, your amendment after paragraph 9 regarding the nuclear power plant in Ostrovets. Then it's easier to read and to understand that your amendment in Ostrovets is completely something different. Stella, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank Mrs. Gunay for preparing this report. And as she has said, it addresses a very important issue that concerns millions of European citizens and beyond. And in her own words, we do see that these nuclear power stations can pose general threats. And we're all aware of the repercussions of tragic nuclear accidents as that of Chernobyl 32 years ago. And in my own country, Cyprus, we are now seeing an increase in the cases of thyroid cancer attributed possibly to Chernobyl. So we need to be aware of nuclear safety, and it must never be compromised. And this is why I was admittedly surprised not to see in the draft resolution any mention of the proposed construction of the Akyüz nuclear plant, which is being built in the Mersin province of Turkey in cooperation with the Russian Federation. This construction has already led to a variety of reactions within Turkey and within neighboring countries. Cyprus is 85 kilometers from this power plant. And the problem with this power plant is that it's being constructed in what is an earthquake-prone Turkish region. In July 2017, in fact, in the European Parliament, when the progress report on Turkey was being discussed, there was a specific resolution related to the Akyüz power plant, quoting, to halt its plan for the construction of the Akyüz nuclear power plant, saying that the site is in a region prone to severe earthquakes, posing a major threat to Turkey and the Mediterranean region, and asking that the Turkish government joins the Espoo Convention, which commits parties to notify and consult each other in major constructions. Therefore, saying the above, and I think it is important that in order to have a balanced and objective report, which I think Mrs. Günay was advocating and saying that this is, we do need to at least make a stronger reference of caution in the draft resolution of the construction of this plant. And this is why I'm proposing this amendment. I don't have any problem, Mr. Chair, in inserting it as a different paragraph, but I do think that it does need a specific reference. I don't know if you want me to read the amendment. I think it's quite balanced. It comes in line with what the European Parliament has put in its resolution, and it is specifically related to the fact that it is an earthquake-prone region. Thank you. Yeah. Do you want me to read the amendment or not?
Sorry, that would be very nice, yes, okay. Because I have it in written form, but our colleagues maybe not.
So the amendment reads, regarding the proposed plans by Turkey and the Russian Federation for the construction of the nuclear power plant of Akyüz in the province of Mersin, Turkey, situated just 85 kilometers from Cyprus and in very close proximity of other neighboring countries, the Assembly expresses its deep concern on the construction of this nuclear power plant in an earthquake-prone region of Turkey. Also, as per the 6th July 2017 European Parliament resolution, and it therefore asks the Turkish government to join the UNECE Espoo Convention and to take into account all cautions as expressed by its own citizens and to consult with neighboring countries according to the International Convention of Nuclear Safety. Thank you.
And this amendment, I ask if we can make own paragraph. It's paragraph 8. Now, what is the opinion of our rapporteur?
Thank you for the additional information. But as I said before, there are 184 reactors or nuclear power plants in Europe already, and 15 are newly constructed. So in order to have a balanced and objective report, I cannot just focus in one nuclear plant that is newly constructed in one country and leave the other 14 in the report. How can we justify this? So in that case, one alternative is to include all the newly constructed ones and all the old ones that possesses high risk to our population and environment. In that case, I really would like to include, for example, the nuclear power plant in Armenia, Metsamor, and it is also declared by the European Union and the United States as the most dangerous nuclear power plant in Europe. It was established in 1970, and it is just 16 kilometers from our border. Or I also would like to add the Kozloduy nuclear power plant in the report, again, which was established in 1970 in Bulgaria, and again, it is very close to our border. So how are we going to draw the limits? So here we are talking about the Belarus nuclear power plant, newly constructed, because, as I said before, the motion, the first motion was given about this nuclear power plant. And then we look at the big picture in Europe. So that's why I am against for this amendment. It's not just fair to include one newly constructed nuclear power plant and leave the other 14, and leave the other, the aging ones, which possess high risk in our region.
Madame Güne, you are right. Kozloduy is one of the most dangerous atomic power station, and it should be closed today and not tomorrow. I don't know, because there is a decision made by the European Union that it should be closed. We have also the opting out of the nuclear power energy in Germany in the next, 20 years. Looking to the German delegates, I don't know, what is your timeline for the opting out of nuclear power energy? But, Mrs. Günay, this is now an amendment which Kerry worries about another planning, which is actual. And when we are doing a report, and there is another planning which is actual, why we cannot put it in. And I think till the end in this resolution, maybe some other come in this report. So now you heard the opinion of our rapporteur. You had listened to the amendment of Stella. Now we have come to Stella, are you...
Yes, I just wanted to say something. I heard Mrs. Günay very carefully, and possibly, Mr. Chair, the reason that we want... my suggestion was to insert it in paragraph 7 and not a separate paragraph, is because there was an extended mention in that paragraph of the nuclear plant in Belarus, which worries, understandably, Lithuania, and I was going to add it in there as an example of another nuclear power plant. So, but I will accept your proposal to make it a separate paragraph.
But for the better understanding, who is reading a resolution, it's easier to understand.
Thank you.
This is not, this is Lithuania, this is Turkey.
Thank you.
This is,
okay,
is something else. I think we should come to an end of the debate. And I ask you, who is in favor of this amendment regarding the proposed plans by Turkey and the Russian Federation for the construction of a nuclear power plant in Akuyu next to the province of Mersin in the southeast of the Turkey? Who is in favor of this amendment?
Can you come down and count as well, please?
As I see, it's the clear majority, so I might make the other example. Who is against this amendment? Please show. One. One against. Abstention. One, two, three, four, five. Can you show again? The abstentions, please. One, two, three, four, five,
six.
So we had one against. 18 in favor and 6 abstentions, so the amendment is adopted. And my proposal was to make a new paragraph 8. And after regarding the nuclear power plant in Ostrovets, to go on with 9. Now I have from Virgilius Boderis an amendment to paragraph 7. Well, I must ask you now to vote for the amended paragraph 7. Who is in favor of the amended paragraph 7? Sorry, we must do it now very correct. No, paragraph 7. Mr. Virekius is paragraph 7.1. It's the sub-paragraph. So, we amended just the paragraph 7. So who is in favor now of the paragraph 7 as it amended? Okay, that includes now the amendment of Stella Kyriakides. Who is against the amended paragraph 7? I think this is not against, huh? No, okay. Nobody is against. Abstentions, please. Nobody. Okay, so seven. Seven?
Several.
Several. One.
You were too fast.
One, two. Okay, thank you. So, paragraph 7 is adopted. Now, 7.1. You have the floor, please, now.
Thank you, Chairman. First of all, my compliments to Mrs. Gunai for excellent piece of work, but nevertheless, I would like to suggest some amendments. And as for 7.1, the essence of my suggestion is to refer not to interim report of NSREC group, but to refer to very final report issued on 2nd of July 2018. That's the essence of my proposal. Should I read it? In paragraph 7.1, after the words peer review, insert words of the Belarus stress test report adopted by NSREC on 2nd July 2018 and noting serious deficiencies of the nuclear power plant.
I'm sorry, I thought you had a compromise and the last word you deleted.
No? Yeah. We agreed with the rapporteur to delete second part of my proposal, yes.
Okay, so your proposal is finished with 2018, yes?
Correct.
Okay. Is this an agreement between you and the rapporteur?
That's correct.
That's correct. So everybody understood. The amendment means the recommendation of EU NSREC European Nuclear Safety Regulations Group peer review of the Belarus stress test report adopted by NSREC on the 2nd July 2018 are fully implemented. Is anybody against this amendment? The rapporteur is in favor. Any abstentions? No. So I can declare your amendment is adopted. Now I came to paragraph 7.2. Anybody against? Any abstentions? Adopted. Paragraph 7.3. Can I go in the same procedure? Nobody's against. No abstentions adopted. Now we came to paragraph 7.4. For the better understanding, I want to make the proposal to Mrs. Günay. At the end of the paragraph, on the basis of the Melk Protocol, a Melk Protocol model, that who is reading this understands, to add the word regarding Temelin between Austria and the Czech Republic. Because what is Melk? Melk is a monastery. Huh? And the Melk Protocol model is called, it's an agreement between two states regarding the nuclear power plant station of Temelin. If you agree, Madam Gunai. So my proposal is, on the basis of the MELK protocol regarding the power plant station Temelin between Austria and the Czech Republic, to add those words. Can you agree into that? Anybody against? Abstentions? So no, it's adopted. Thank you. Now I come to 7.5, and I give the floor back to Mr. Poderes. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairman. The essence of my suggestion is to urge project developers to ask International Atomic Agency to perform full scope site evaluation, because it's missing till now. So, of course. In paragraph 7.5, at the end, add words as follows: as well as full scope of IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency Site Evaluation Mission, Site and External Events Design Review Service, or SEED, is invited to assess the NPP site in a comprehensive manner.
Thank you. As I understood, this is a compromise between the rapporteur and the mover of this amendment. Yes or no?
Yes. The Belarus-hosted IAEA site and external event design service, so they're already cooperating, so no problem.
So we add four lines at the words Aarhus Convention. So... Is that clear for all of you? Is anybody against those four lines? Any abstentions? So I can declare it as adopted. Now, paragraph 8. I'm looking around. Nobody against. No interventions. Adopted. 8.1. So I can declare it as adopted. Please, can you... put down, I always think you make an intervention, so thank you very much. 8.2. No abstentions, nobody against. Thank you, adopted. 8.3. No abstentions, nobody against, adopted. 8.4. Nobody against, no abstentions, adopted. 8.5. In the same procedure, I can declare it as adopted. 8.6. I'm looking around. I can declare it as unanimously adopted. So now we have the last 8.7. It's adopted. 8.8. It's adopted. Thank you. Paragraph 9. Anybody against? Abstentions? So I can declare it as adopted. And finally, paragraph 10. I can declare it as adopted. I know. Before we vote now for this report in whole, as we amend it now, I give the floor to Stella.
Thank you. Just very briefly, I may be presenting a dissenting opinion on the report, so I will not be taking part in the vote. I think I have 48 hours to do that, yes? Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you for this declaration. Now we are coming for the vote in whole of the report as we amended. Who is in favor? Please, now you have to show to be in favor.
You are in favor of your report, Madame Gune?
No, not right now.
Okay, not right now. Okay.
With the recent amendments, it's not my report anymore.
Okay. Okay, then who is against this report? Any abstentions? One, two, three, and I think Madame Gune, is your abstention? Abstentions? 4 and Madame Benning is 5. Okay. Okay, so the report is adopted, 15 in favor and 5 abstentions. Congratulations. This report will be debated on Thursday, yes?
Wednesday
afternoon. It sounds like a song, huh? Wednesday afternoon. Okay. As we know, a lot of colleagues ask to be part of the debate, so I don't need to, it's not necessary to make advertisement to ask for the floor in the plenary, but at the moment, as we know, that there are more than 25 colleagues ask for the floor. Who is this gentleman? Den haben wir hier, ne? Ja, okay. So, Jennifer, the Denver man, I hope you feel better. I hope the medicine worked, because the next topic is your topic. Do you want to come in front, or you want to speak from your place? It's okay. Now we have the hearing on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, how parliaments and member states of the Council of Europe can contribute. And now I can warmly welcome Secretary of State José Luis Carneiro. Jennifer, we make a short break. We have all the possibility for a coffee, and maybe you can have a tea, and maybe it's better. So we have now 10 minutes break. So please take seat. We start now with the hearing on the Substantial Development Goal of the United Nations. It's a very interesting podium. Next to me, the Secretary of State of the Portuguese Communities, Mr. José Luis Carneiro. Further, Mrs. Santos, Marta Santos Baez. This is the Special Representative of the United Nations, Secretary General on Violence Against Children. And also Ambassador José Rui Carajo, Director of the Council of the European North-South Center, where we have an invitation this evening. But, dear guests, before we start, I want to give, for a short introduction, the floor to Jennifer de Timmerman. Jennifer, she is our rapporteur. You don't feel good, or...? Only very briefly, please.
Oui. Chers collègues, je vais d'abord solliciter votre bienveillance et compréhension, parce que, comme vous pouvez le constater, je suis un peu malade. Je tiens à remercier la délégation portugaise pour son invitation, qui nous permet d'avoir parmi nous trois intervenants de qualité, dont je ne doute pas que les propos seront très instructifs et éclairants pour mon rapport. J'ai grand plaisir à travailler sur les objectifs de développement durable et l'agenda 2030. Alors, je vais commencer par vous confier quelque chose de mon expérience personnelle, c'est que quand je suis arrivée à l'Assemblée parlementaire du Conseil de l'Europe, en fait, je n'avais jamais entendu parler des objectifs de développement durable. C'est assez symptomatique, en réalité. C'est que il y a un peu plus d'un an en France, avec l'émergence du groupe La République En Marche, des gens comme moi, de la vie civile, sont arrivés au Parlement. Et si je ne connaissais pas les ODD, c'est parce qu'en réalité, ça me semblait... c'était éloigné de mon quotidien de gestionnaire de collège. Pourtant, à ma manière, on peut dire que je contribuais à ces objectifs parce que j'accordais des aides sociales aux enfants pour réduire les inégalités. J'étais impliquée dans une alimentation saine et durable avec du bio et du local. J'essayais de faire des économies d'énergie et d'avoir un impact à ce sujet. Et je participais aussi au monde de l'éducation. Mais en réalité, je n'en avais pas conscience. Donc, ça, c'est ma première réflexion. C'est comment faire progresser les objectifs de développement durable si les citoyens, en tout cas la plupart des citoyens, ne les connaissent pas. Après avoir découvert ces objectifs, j'en ai parlé autour de moi à l'Assemblée nationale et j'ai fait le même constat. Les parlementaires, eux-mêmes, mes collègues, ne les connaissaient pas. Donc, comment progresser dans ces conditions? Donc, une de mes premières pistes de travail, c'est comment faire pour communiquer davantage sur ces objectifs de développement durable. J'espère que ce rapport, en toute humilité, permettra de les mettre davantage en avant. C'est pas que rien n'est fait ou que les objectifs ne progressent pas à travers le monde, mais nous n'en avons pas forcément conscience. Et ça, à mon avis, ça relève d'un deuxième problème. C'est comment savoir où nous en sommes si nous n'avons pas de critères d'évaluation. En juillet, je me suis rendue avec la délégation française au Forum politique de haut niveau, donc à l'ONU à New York, où tous les ans, les États et leurs représentants, les ONG, les entreprises font le point sur les avancées. Et nous avons rencontré le ministre de l'Environnement de Finlande, qui nous a expliqué comment son gouvernement s'était emparé de la question, notamment dans l'élaboration de son budget. Et là, c'est un troisième point dans mes pistes de travail, c'est quel rôle du budget et de la législation et en quoi le rôle justement des parlementaires devrait être essentiel pour l'avancée des objectifs de développement durable. Donc, je ne vais pas vous relire ma note introductrice, déjà parce que j'en serais physiquement pas capable, mais voilà, le rapport va me permettre de faire un peu le point sur les actions entreprises par les États membres et le rôle que nous, parlementaires, nous avons à jouer davantage dans la question. Donc c'est pourquoi je me permettrai de vous solliciter, mes chers collègues, pour que vous puissiez contribuer aussi par des exemples concrets de ce qui se fait dans vos pays. J'ai également l'honneur de vous demander deux choses aujourd'hui. La première est de déclassifier cette note introductrice. La seconde est de m'autoriser à faire un déplacement qui reste encore à définir à l'heure actuelle. Et enfin, avant d'écouter nos intervenants, je voulais juste vous rappeler que ce soir, je vous ai proposé une visite de l'Energy Observer, donc qui est un navire autonome, et dont le capitaine est le premier ambassadeur français des objectifs de développement durable. Voilà, je vous remercie de votre attention.
Merci, Jennifer. I was 8 year president for the Union of the Mediterranean and responsible for renewable and sustainable development. And in all that time, there was one strong partner from France. It was a senator, Simon Satour. Maybe you should come in contact with him. And the first woman as general secretary of IRENA is also from France. And she was excellent mover of sustainable goals, and I was very deep impressed. Now, Mr. Secretary of State, the floor is yours, please.
Bom dia a todas e a todos. Queria, em primeiro lugar, saudar o presidente desta comissão, Stefan Chenac. Quero agradecer-lhe o trabalho que tem vindo a desenvolver e formular votos para que esta audição e esta reflexão contribuam para o aperfeiçoamento das políticas, nomeadamente das políticas sociais, de saúde e também do desenvolvimento sustentável. Gostaria de saudar e de cumprimentar a representante especial do Secretário-Geral das Nações Unidas sobre a violência contra as crianças, Marta Santos Pais, e ainda o Sr. Embaixador José Rui Caroço, a quem quero formular votos das maiores felicidades para o desempenho das suas funções. Ele acaba de chegar dos Estados Unidos da América e dirige-se rapidamente para esta nova função. E queria também deixar ficar uma palavra na abertura deste diálogo que queria manter convosco ao Sr. Embaixador António Gamito, pelo trabalho que desenvolveu nesta responsabilidade relativa ao Centro Norte-Sul do Conselho da Europa. Saúdo ainda os responsáveis da política externa do Ministério dos Negócios Estrangeiros, que aqui nos acompanham, e queria saudar os Srs. Deputados à Assembleia da República Portuguesa, o Sr. Deputado Luís Ramos, o Sr. Deputado Paulo Pisco e também a Sra. Deputada Edith Estrela. E saúdo-vos a todas e a todos, desejando um trabalho frutuoso. Eu gostava de vos deixar ficar 9 notas sobre o modo como Portugal vê os mecanismos de implementação e de avaliação, monitorização da estratégia e dos objetivos da estratégia para o desenvolvimento sustentável. Mas não o queria fazer sem, em primeiro lugar e como primeira consideração, referir que Portugal tem bem presente a importância do Conselho da Europa enquanto espaço fundador, não apenas da paz, mas também da perspectiva do bem-estar, da segurança coletiva, após a tragédia da Segunda Guerra Mundial. E o Conselho da Europa é, para o nosso país e para o conjunto dos portugueses, o momento fundador e inspirador do futuro Parlamento Europeu e aquele grande espaço de conceptualização dos conceitos relativos à paz e ao desenvolvimento. A segunda palavra, a segunda nota, tem a ver com o facto de, para nós, a Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa constitui hoje a mais importante voz de toda a Europa, na medida em que representa mais de 830 milhões de cidadãos que têm neste espaço um espaço plural, diverso, de aperfeiçoamento dos conceitos que orientam as políticas públicas tendentes à concretização do bem-estar e do desenvolvimento, mas também um espaço que valoriza as múltiplas dimensões da expressão da sociedade civil no âmbito das suas organizações não-governamentais. A terceira palavra, a terceira nota que queria deixar tem a ver com o seguinte. Entendemos também que os objetivos do desenvolvimento sustentável hoje procuram ter uma interpretação holística dos problemas e procura também apresentar soluções globais para o conjunto das dificuldades com que se confrontam as sociedades. Uma abordagem que é não apenas global, sistémica, mas ao mesmo tempo também o procura ser do ponto de vista do modelo de governação. Na medida em que, por um lado, considera, e do ponto de vista da sua visão global, considera e articula os direitos humanos com a qualidade da democracia, com as formas de governação e também com o Estado de Direito. Eu diria que num aperfeiçoamento muito completo daquilo que foram os grandes compromissos da Agenda para o Desenvolvimento dos primórdios da década de 90, e introduz-lhe aquela que é talvez uma das conquistas mais importantes dos últimos 20 anos e que tem que ver com o modelo de governação e as opções relativas ao modelo de governação. E aqui este trabalho que estamos a realizar, este trabalho de valorização do Parlamento e dos Parlamentos Nacionais enquanto atores que tanto conduzem contributos das sociedades civis para o Conselho da Europa, como ao mesmo tempo são também instrumentos de fiscalização e de monitorização e de avaliação da implementação das opções conceptuais relativas ao desenvolvimento, efetivamente do que estamos a falar é de uma abordagem que é multinível. Multinível na sua concepção, porque é o contributo dos atores organizados da sociedade civil, é o contributo do conjunto dos Parlamentos Nacionais que contribuem para a primeira fase da conceptualização do desenvolvimento, mas é ao mesmo tempo essa força que tem a sua origem na sociedade civil e que também tem a sua origem na representação parlamentar que faz com que efetivamente se possa falar de uma abordagem e de uma perspectiva multinível que, traduzindo-se numa forma de governação, numa metodologia de governação mais aperfeiçoada, mais qualificada, corresponde também a uma visão mais integrada, mais global, mais sistémica, mais holística do desenvolvimento. E, portanto, está em conformidade com a própria resolução 45, o parágrafo 45 da resolução 70/2001 da Assembleia Geral das Nações Unidas, onde efetivamente se considera os parlamentos como espaços, como a sede, uma das sedes mais importantes, não apenas pela autoridade democrática na elaboração, na conceptualização do processo legislativo, como também na aprovação dos próprios instrumentos orçamentais. Uma palavra adicional que acrescento, acho que já deixei ficar, tem a ver com o seguinte. Entendemos também, entende o governo português, que esta articulação da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa com os Parlamentos Nacionais e destes Parlamentos Nacionais com os governos tem uma função importante e deve ter uma regularidade também seja sistémica para conseguir garantir o bom acompanhamento das opções de estratégia relativas ao desenvolvimento. E desse ponto de vista, o Governo e Portugal adotou em julho de 2017, um relatório voluntário nacional. Esse relatório voluntário nacional procura, fundamentalmente, avaliar em cada uma das áreas governativas o modo como as prioridades políticas do governo em cada uma das áreas governativas estão, por um lado, em conformidade com os objetivos do milénio e, em segundo lugar, estando em conformidade, como é que, do ponto de vista da sua implementação, os seus efeitos são aqueles que se aguardam na sua conceptualização e no seu processo de devolução aos respectivos Estados para efeitos de implementação. No seguimento desse relatório voluntário nacional, foi proposto ao Parlamento a criação de uma comissão parlamentar para acompanhar a implementação dos objetivos sobre o desenvolvimento sustentável. E foi proposto ao Parlamento a criação dessa comissão, tendo precisamente como objetivo garantir coerência entre os conceitos e a implementação das respectivas políticas e, posteriormente, a avaliação dos seus efeitos no conjunto das vidas das nossas populações, no conjunto das nossas sociedades. No seguimento dessa orientação política, o Parlamento, na sua autonomia e na sua soberania, criou uma comissão eventual de acompanhamento relativo à definição do novo quadro financeiro plurianual no que diz respeito à estratégia de desenvolvimento de Portugal para 2030. Sendo certo que essa comissão eventual está concentrada naqueles que são os obstáculos que importa remover relativos ao desenvolvimento do país para um percurso que nos levará até 2030, em articulação com a própria União Europeia, o certo é que nos resultados desse relatório voluntário nacional foi feita a sugestão de que esta comissão criada pelo Parlamento integrasse dois guiões. Um desses guiões, precisamente o guião dos Objetivos para o Desenvolvimento Sustentável. E um segundo guião, as conclusões do Relatório Voluntário Nacional, tendo em vista garantir que essa comissão eventual, que está a desenvolver o seu trabalho, tendo em vista remover os obstáculos do desenvolvimento do país para a próxima Estratégia de Desenvolvimento a ser aprovada no seio da União Europeia, possa incorporar, de uma forma mais lata, de uma forma mais global, os objetivos do desenvolvimento sustentável e, ao mesmo tempo, a avaliação que foi realizada no âmbito do relatório voluntário nacional. E, outra nota, praticamente para concluir, foram estabelecidas áreas de prioridade para esse trabalho. E, nomeadamente, e são áreas de trabalho que têm muito que ver com os obstáculos ao desenvolvimento que o país terá que vencer. E são eles quatro grandes objetivos. O primeiro, que aliás está muito em conformidade com as orientações e com as preocupações refletidas nos documentos do Conselho da Europa, em primeiro lugar, as pessoas, como primeira prioridade, e tudo o que tem que ver com a promoção de uma sociedade mais inclusiva e menos desigual. Entrando aqui um conjunto de variáveis relativas à inclusão, que certamente haverá depois lugar para podermos trocar algumas impressões sobre as mesmas. A segunda prioridade, as questões relacionadas com a inovação. A inovação centrada nas transformações da economia e nos impactos dessas transformações, nomeadamente no domínio do emprego e no domínio das políticas sociais, mas também a inovação centrada numa ótica de transferência de conhecimento, de transferência de saber, da transferência da criatividade dos centros de investigação, das universidades, para a estrutura social, para a estrutura económica, para a estrutura produtiva do país. Uma terceira prioridade tem a ver com aquilo que poderíamos considerar o grande desafio demográfico, que é um desafio que todos enfrentamos, nomeadamente os países no quadro da União Europeia, mas que é também muito significativo no país e que tem a ver com a sustentabilidade e a valorização dos recursos endógenos dos territórios. A sustentabilidade das políticas adotadas e, simultaneamente, com a valorização de recursos endógenos dos territórios e transitando por uma quarta prioridade, que está intimamente articulada com esta e que tem que ver com a necessidade de sermos capazes de trabalhar na competitividade dos territórios, contudo, sem perder de vista a importância da coesão territorial, da coesão social e da coesão económica, na medida em que são faces da mesma moeda. Alguns, aliás, daquelas que são também prioridades, quer do Conselho da Europa, quer da União Europeia. Queria, por último, referir que o Conselho da Europa tem dado um importante contributo para alcançarmos os objetivos do desenvolvimento sustentável, num trabalho que se desenvolve em vários âmbitos da ação. Quer no âmbito da Assembleia Parlamentar, este trabalho que estamos hoje aqui a desenvolver é da maior importância, quer depois no âmbito das suas comissões temáticas, e gostaria de sublinhar muito particularmente as questões relacionadas com a saúde de qualidade, com a educação de qualidade, com a igualdade de género, com a procura de um trabalho digno e um crescimento económico que seja sustentável e que seja coeso, e depois as questões relacionadas com as alterações climáticas, assim como a proteção da vida marinha, bem como a qualificação das instituições em tudo que são os valores da paz, da justiça e a garantia de modelos de governação que garantam, por um lado, essa abordagem multinível que é vertical, mas que é horizontal e que envolve parceiros públicos e também parceiros sociais e parceiros privados. Agradeço mais uma vez a vossa atenção, felicito mais uma vez também o trabalho do Sr. Embaixador António Gamito pelo trabalho que desenvolveu na responsabilidade de diretor do Centro Norte-Sul e formulo as maiores felicidades ao Sr. Embaixador José Rui Caruso para este trabalho agora de direção do Centro Norte-Sul e queria manifestar o total compromisso do Estado português, o total compromisso do Ministério dos Negócios Estrangeiros português na persecução não apenas das opções de política, mas muito particularmente também nas opções relativas à implementação e à monitorização dos seus efeitos na vida das nossas comunidades locais.
Thank you very, very much. You made a really big framework about that, and I think this is important, everything what you filled in. By the way, I am thankful over the years to work very closely with Secretary of State Teresa Ribeiro. She was my genius partner in all sustainable questions. And another person who supported me from Portuguese was Eduardo Carpito. He also fully understand what is the question of the time. And with those two supports, I survived the last 8 years in this position. Now, Mrs. Baiz, I hope that my Portuguese is coming better. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Mr. President, Mr. Secretary of State, and Mr. Ambassador Rui Caroço, now leading the center-north-south of the Council of Europe, dear friends, members of the important Committee on Social Affairs, Health and Sustainable Development. I'm really very happy to be once again before your committee, but I am particularly happy that this meeting is taking place in Lisbon, in Portugal, my own country. And by that, you're giving me a wonderful opportunity to come back to Lisbon and to be part of your very important discussions. I'm afraid I'm going to speak in English, not in Portuguese, as perhaps I should. But I wanted to reach out to each and every of you. First of all, I would like to say that we are so excited by the opportunity promoted by the Sustainable Development Agenda. Not only it provides us with a very ambitious vision, as you know, of transforming the world by 2030, which is around the corner, in creating a world free from fear, from want, and from violence for each and every member of society, but in addition, for the first time, it has made clear that human rights and development go together and are inherently connected, and only by investing in these two very important dimensions, we can achieve social progress, leaving no one behind. And leaving no one behind is a beautiful value in the agenda, but it's not a slogan. And we want it to be really the indicator of progress in each and every corner of the world. Of course, many children have been left behind. And as you will guess, in my role as Special Representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations on Violence Against Children, today I would like to tell you a little bit about how we are looking at this reality and how we are trying to ensure that by leaving no child behind, we leave children a first priority in all the policy decisions, in all budgets that are adopted, in all laws that are enacted, in each and every piece of action that policymakers and especially parliamentarians can undertake in their own countries. Very briefly, let me recall something that is obvious for all of you. The right of the child to protection from all forms of violence, including sexual abuse and exploitation, and I know many of you are very active defenders of this area, but also online violence or simply corporal punishment within the family or aggression within care and justice and protection institutions is a reality that the Convention on the Rights of the Child has recognized almost 30 years ago. And as you know, all members of the Council of Europe have since very early ratified this important convention, and there is an extraordinary rich process of implementation that your committee has been following and to which it has been making fundamental contributions. But when states were asked about the reality of violence against children within their own borders, it was clear that most of them didn't have enough information to even know what the magnitude of the problem was, who was most affected, and what were the real causes behind. And for that reason, the United Nations decided to undertake a global study on violence against children and to establish a special position next to the Secretary General to ensure that we bridge the actions of all parts of the United Nations system, work with all nations, and bring together all sectors and disciplines that have an impact on the life of children. This is the position I have been honored to hold for almost, in fact, for 9 years, exactly 9 years. Now, the Council of Europe has been a steady defender of this process, and as you will recall, in 2006, already it adopted the program to build a Europe for and with children, and since then has adopted important strategies on the rights of the child, where the protection of children from violence has been at the center of its concerns. This is again the case in relation to the Council of Europe strategy on the rights of the child 2016-2021, adopted in Sofia, Bulgaria, in 2016. Now, I'm saying this because, of course, we need to realize that by investing in the protection of children from violence, we have been able to achieve very important progress around the world. And we are, in fact, very confident that by joining hands together, we can build a world free from violence for all children in all parts of the world, including across the European region. But we are also very confident because the Sustainable Development Agenda has included a very specific target that requires each and every state to eliminate all forms of violence by 2030. And it has, in addition, introduced a number of indicators that help states monitor how far they are moving, including through the national report, as was the case of Portugal a year ago, the national reports presented to the high-level political forum in the United Nations in New York. Now, this agenda is special in many reasons, but there is one I want to stress very quickly. It was done with a wide participation of citizens and parliaments and actors from all sectors, but also by children. More than 800,000 children from different parts of the world contributed to the shaping of this agenda. And it is incredibly important to note that violence against children was always at the top of their concerns in whatever region we considered. So we are now trying to respect the ambition of the kids, and they look at us, of course, with very high expectations. Now, this is very important because the magnitude of violence remains extremely wide. I would like you to know that every 5 minutes somewhere in the world there is a child that dies as a result of violence. Every year, at least 1 billion children suffer some form of violence. This is half of all children in the whole world. They suffer physical, psychological, sexual violence, or online violence, or other forms, as you know. And to me, what is particularly dramatic is that violence starts in the first years of life. A very recent study by UNICEF has underscored that it is very common for families to use shouting, yelling, and screaming at kids below the age of one as a form of correction and punishment. And you may know that every year 300 million children between 2 and 4 years of age suffer on a regular basis physical and psychological aggression. And just to use another statistical information, 15 million adolescent girls before the age of 15 suffer some form of forced sexual abuse. I say this because the Parliamentary Assembly has been very active in areas such as this, and the campaign One in Five that has been supported by so many national parliaments has been fundamental to raise awareness of the topic and to mobilize action at the national and regional level. Now, the impact of violence is dramatic and is long-lasting. It compromises the ability of children to learn, to have a healthy life, including having a healthy mental life and development. But it also has very dramatic costs in terms of what is spent to correct the situations provoked by violence. And many of those who are victims of violence become perpetrators and very often easily become involved in risky actions and also in criminal activities. Of course, societies cannot pay those costs. I would like you to know that every year the cost of violence against children is considered to be 8% of global GDP. Imagine what we could use to invest in prevention rather than in remedial action. I'm sure you will help us mobilize parliaments around Europe to take this very seriously. Now, coming back to the Sustainable Development Agenda, we want children to be at the heart, and we want the protection of children from violence to be at the heart of every action. And what can we do to make it happen? First of all, you know that each country is required to have a national sustainable development strategy, an agenda that is developed with a wide participatory process in which all sectors of society participate, including parliamentarians, as is the case in Portugal with the commission that has been set up, but also an agenda that is based not on assumptions but on solid evidence and on very strong data, disaggregated in a very important manner to inform decisions. And, of course, an agenda that is supported by predictable and firm resources. For that reason, the budgets allocated by national parliaments are, of course, of critical value. And there are many things we can, you know, celebrate. Many countries with legislation to prohibit all forms of violence against children, many countries with national agendas. But at the regional level, the action is equally important. And in that regard, I want to recall again the regional strategy of the Council of Europe on the rights of the child and the important legal standards that have been adopted, for instance, to prevent domestic violence or sexual abuse and exploitation with the Istanbul and Lanzarote Conventions of the Council of Europe, but also the monitoring bodies that have been set by the Council, for instance, the Ad Hoc Committee on the Rights of the Child and its Subcommittee on Violence, to ensure that monitoring is a regular action and we know how far we are moving or not moving and what may be the challenges that need to be overcome. But as you know, an agenda may be beautiful only if it achieves change at the national level. And for that to be a reality, the voluntary national review reports promoted by countries around the world are very important to be an instrument of promoting a self-critical assessment of the reality in the country, to identify areas where progress is not happening, and to mobilize resources and action for the future. These reports are submitted to the high-level political forum that meets every year in New York. And as we have heard, parliamentarians are, of course, an important actor. And I think it would be important for you to feel encouraged to participate in the sessions and influence the outcome of those sessions. But I want particularly to tell you about an opportunity we all have for next year, 2019. 2019 is a very special year for the Sustainable Development Agenda. It will be the first time where the General Assembly of the United Nations will meet in a high-level summit with the participation of heads of state and heads of government to evaluate progress in the implementation of the Sustainable Development Agenda. And one of the key areas that it will review is exactly the protection of children from violence. So in July next year, the high-level political forum will meet to review progress. 42 countries have already committed to promoting reports to that high-level political forum, including in Europe, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia, France, Iceland, Serbia, and the United Kingdom. And I hope that other countries represented here will feel encouraged to make their reports submitted at that time, because we can influence what is the acceleration of progress that is going to happen after 2019. In September 2019, as I said, the General Assembly will meet to have the first stock-taking of how far the international community has been able to move in the implementation of the agenda. But also next year, for us in the child rights area, we are going to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the adoption of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's not a child anymore. It's not an adolescent anymore. 30 years of experience will help all countries in the world to really accelerate progress in the whole of the Sustainable Development Agenda. So we are very interested in mobilizing action, and we would like very much to collaborate with you. What could the Parliamentary Assembly and your committee do? Let me share some ideas in that regard. First of all, we see how important it is when the committee or the Parliamentary Assembly as a whole has a parliamentary debate to review the trends and the signals of progress that are taking place across Europe in the implementation of the Sustainable Development Agenda, particularly in the areas covered more specifically by your very important commission. In addition, of course, the committee can support and encourage member states to adopt the laws that will protect children from violence, the budgets that will ensure effective implementation, the monitoring tools and the data that will help assess how well children are being affected and how implementation is moving forward. But in addition, of course, you can help us mobilize all countries in Europe to be represented at the General Assembly next year at the highest possible level and to be informed in such a deep manner that the rights of the child will be at the heart of the contributions of each and every state, and the protection of children from violence will be not a footnote, but it will be a central dimension and message that you will convey. I'm very confident that we will be able to celebrate next year something really, really impressive. And the final point I wanted to make, in my mandate, global mandate on violence against children, we don't want to miss this opportunity. And we are really committed to ensuring that by next year we will have a global thematic report that will document the very best experiences that have taken place around the world and the reflections from parliaments and policymakers that can help us galvanize those that are not yet convinced of the value of the Sustainable Development Agenda and of the importance of investing in children if we want to achieve progress, lasting peace, and human development for each and every member of society, leaving no child behind. And I would like to finish by saying we would love to count on your support in the development of this global thematic report, and I stand ready, of course, to collaborate very closely with you in the months ahead and today, naturally. So, Mr. President, let me thank you again for the opportunity of addressing you today, and let me say I feel humbled and honored to be with you, and I'm sure that we will continue to cooperate very closely. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mrs. Baij. It was very impressive to listen to you, and I'm sure that Doreen, Baroness of Messe, our chair of the subcommittee on children, will ask later for the floor in that way. Now, Mr. You are very good friends. Okay. Then everything is very clear. The inspiration of two such active women. Now, Mr. Ambassador, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Obrigado. Good morning. Bom dia. First of all, Chairperson Stefan Senak, the rapporteur, Ms. Jennifer Fennerman. Also, I would like to say, and the Secretary, to say thanks to the Secretary of State of the Portuguese Communities here, Secretário de Estado das Comunidades Portuguesas, Dr. José Luís Carneiro, and the representative of the United Nations Secretary General, Dra. Marta Paes. Members of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, so, and other guests here present, it's really for me a pleasure to be here as the new director of the North-South Center, and I just took this mission and this assignment a couple of days ago. So I also would like to publicly recognize and say thanks to my predecessor, Ambassador Antonio Gamito, who also have been very helpful in this transition. So having said that, I would like very briefly to say what is or what are the contributions, specifically one that the North-South Center of the Council of Europe here in Lisbon could give in what relates the sustainable development goals, the implementation of them. So the existing links between the Center and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and also some proposals in terms of actions with you, of course. So, as you know, the North-South Center has three main areas in what relates the youth, the women, and the education. And the North-South Center of the Council of Europe has developed the concept of global education that incorporates competence for formal and non-formal educators in the field of the human rights, intercultural dialogue, peace and conflict prevention, and sustainable development. So this encompasses many of the sustainable development goals, in particular the goals 4, 5, 16, 17, 1, 10, 11, 12, 13. So instead of numbers, of course, as you know, we are talking about quality education, gender equality, peace and justice, partnership for the goals, no poverty, reduce inequalities, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption, and climate action. So, in promoting those values, namely for the global education, corresponding to the sustainable development goals, the Center do that in three main dimensions or pillars. First one, by the pedagogical support. So in formal and non-formal educators, like the handbooks, e-learning courses, training of youth. So in order to multiply and promote the concepts of the sustainable development goals and methodology, training of experts on women participation in public, providing online and outside spaces, so all kind of tools in terms of training to access to the rights and also to combat to the human's access, to combat violence against women, and also all new kinds of forms of violence. Secondly, also by advocacy, in the framework of the quadrilogue as the European Congress at national and in regional seminars and follow-up meetings by promoting and monitoring recommendations in the field of policymaking and curricular development, professional development of educators, quality support, awareness raising and pedagogical tools by the workshops and trainings, also the capacity of the organizations. Thirdly, by the network of, namely, the National Global Education Coordinations, liaising the work with the center, coordinating and yearly awareness raising, also in the Global Education Weeks, with the Aeromed Women Network, with the Network of Universities on Youth and Global Citizenship. So it's really important for the NowSense Center, the bottom-up and the participatory approach, especially now in a moment, as we all know, there is a little bit of concern about some shrinking space in the civil society worldwide. So the relevance of setting space for dialogue, the North-South Center trusts in the young people, in the individuals, in the youth organizations with whom we have been partnering for a very long time, as you also know, and acknowledging them as full agents of development with their campaigns, with their proposals, with their capacity to building programs, strength of the mobilization, the work, and the networks. So the youth organizations play here, I think, a key role. And the North-South Centers also works with youth policies, also in a global and an inter-regional youth process. Our creating those paths for dialogue, we coordinate and we facilitate the networks of universities on youth and global citizenship. This happened, for instance, with the University on Youth and Development, the Mediterranean University of Youth and Global Citizenship, as it has occurred in May in Tunisia. We also encourage the definition of a common agenda and the implementation of common actions to foster democratic participation and global citizenship among young people, contributing to the spread of the universal principles, values, and standards of the Council of Europe and of the United Nations 2013 Agenda for the Sustainable Development. So, empowering and developing those capacities of the young people through specific education programs based on the paradigm of global development education, and this is really also what we are doing and organizing our activities also in cooperation in the framework of the program iLegend with the European Union and many training courses and experting meetings. So since 2015, the North-South Center has introduced in its global education advocacy capacity building and awareness, raising actions, the reference of the Sustainable Development Goals, underlined the complementaries between the global education concept and the Sustainable Development Goals. The goals number 4, 5, 16, 17. So the Sustainable Development Goals are also integrating in the moderating process of the global education in our regional seminars. Currently, the global education guidelines are being reviewed and the complementarities between global education and the Sustainable Development Goals are underlined through the revised chapter, in particular the chapters relating to concepts and methodology. So the North-South Center is in the process of reinforcing this complementarity by introducing the reference to development in the concept of global education and referring the future to the global, we are now the concept of global development education. So for that, the North-South Center relays the outcomes of the recommendations of the global development education through the seminars, through the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe Secretariat, and in particular with the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe Committee on Culture, Science, Education, and also the Media. So we note that the Global Education Regional Seminars, that the members of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, yourselves and the delegations, are of course of crucial importance among other quadrilogue representatives, and of course are more than welcome, invited to those meetings. In relation to the empowerment of women, the North-South Centre has worked also closely with the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and its project, the North-South Process for the Empowerment of Women, the joint initiative between the North-South Centre and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, that also resulted in the recommendation 1996 in 2012. So the impact in terms of advocacy and recognition of in the global development education would even gain with a closer and continuous collaboration between the members of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe delegations and the North South Centre regional partners at the national level, and also in the follow-up and implementation mechanisms of the regional seminar recommendations. So for this purpose, the constitution of national quadrilogue task force have of course been encouraged. So within our common objective to combat violence against women in the Euro-Mediterranean region, for instance, the cooperation between North-South Centre and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe Committee on Equality, on Non-Discrimination, is gaining also strength through recent and upcoming activities to bring together the North-South Centre network, for instance, of women organizations, the Parliamentary Network of Women Free from Violence, and we have recently parliamentarians from Jordan, from Morocco, from Tunisia, from Palestine. So now, if you allow me in a more personal note, if I may say so, and I have just been in this task, as I said, just a couple of days, I had the opportunity to be in Spain for one of those universities of global development education, where the main focus was really the sustainable development goals in Molina. And it was the 90th edition. Next year it will be the 20th. And I was at the open ceremony, and during the whole week, lots more, around 200 young people coming from 58 different countries were there specifically to discuss the sustainable development goals. And of course, this is one of the activities and the projects, among others, that the North-South Center really takes, is proud and really takes in charge and promotes and organizes. And it was really interesting because, for instance, we had the actual president of the European Youth Forum that was in one of those initiatives many years ago, and others, people really from the civil society, young people that were debating and incorporating and among themselves with different perspectives coming from very different backgrounds. And I think this is really important, and this is really what we are aimed from in terms of the education and the youth and what we should be doing. And sometimes, because there are not the necessary resources, because we know that some people from some countries could not come because there are some logistical problems, and through the years, perhaps we are not paying sufficient attention to this dimension, it is necessity, and the cause, if you may say so, only sees sometimes the consequences of what is happening nowadays worldwide and in the context of the Europe and its neighborhood, namely in the North Africa or in the South Mediterranean. So the North-South Center, our shareholders, if I may say so, to use a business language, first of all, are yourselves, the parliamentarians. So the parliamentarians of the assembly of the Council of Europe are, of course, our stakeholders, but also the government. And I here would like to see the support that the Secretary of State of the Portuguese Community of Ministers of Foreign Affairs gave once more of the Portuguese government to the activities and of the center that is based here in Lisbon. And the center relies on your support, on the governments at region and local government, as you know. And last but not least, of course, the civil society. So the people, which is, of course, the raison d'etre of all democratic and legitimate institutional power. So in the ADN of the North-South Center itself is, through the quadrilogue, this connection between this bottom-up approach, and we had this capacity to really see from the grass what are the main concerns, what are the ideas, what are the expectations, namely, of the youth people. So this is why, in a time of course, where instead of making walls, we should, of course, making bridges, and when we all know that times are, of course, not so easy, and sometimes are hard, and coming from a place and using or paraphrasing the very well-known phrase of President Kennedy when he said we must go to the moon not because it's easy but because it's hard. So I think our task in promoting the sustainable development goals, especially now in the environment that we are living, we need, of course, all the support, all the engagement, all the motivation, and of course here in the center we are more than happy to work with you and to give our humble contribute to that. So thank you very much, and I am, of course, and in the center of the team at your disposal as always. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear from you and from your perspective regarding the North-South Center. In the past, when we had the debate about the future of the North-South Center, this committee was always strongly behind the North-South Center, and we will be in the future strongly behind you and your work. And now I ask if there are some comments. I said before, I'm sure that Doreen will ask for the floor, and she get it immediately, and after Sergei from Ukraine. Yes.
She has asked for the floor, and she's got it, so I want to make some comments. I have found this morning extremely exciting, very inspiring. I thank Marta and Jose for their comments, and Marta is always both passionate and practical at the same time. And I want to link what she and Jose have said to the paper done by Jennifer and talk about how we might develop that a bit in a bit more extensive way. Of course, she's absolutely right in so many things. I just want to pick up on one thing, which is that two things. First of all, if we do not focus our work on children and young people and empower them, then the SDGs will be diluted.
Thank you.
And I firmly believe, as I know some people, other people in this room do believe, that young people are advocates for change. They're not, as we sometimes label them, problems. They're actually advocates for change and very powerful ones. And as she says, next year is very important with all these exciting meetings coming up. But I think the thing that struck me so much about what she said was that countries must monitor the SDGs. I think monitoring is so often left out of really inspirational good ideas, that we have the ideas, we have the initiatives, but we don't follow them through. And I think we have to do that very carefully in this. And that could action change at a national level. I think that child and adolescent health is absolutely key to all this, and I shall come back to that in a minute. I am so pleased that Jose was here to talk about this very exciting North-South Centre with Global Education and Global Citizenship as its foundations, and the regional activities, of course. What excites me also is that youth organisations are involved in this centre. And you may like to know, to follow up something we talked about yesterday, that the Subcommittee on Children, which I chair, and this committee, this Social Affairs Committee, have put forward an idea of how we can better involve young people in the Council of Europe. Things are happening already, but we want to make them more powerful and more coordinated. And we will be meeting the President of the Parliamentary Assembly in October to look at how we might do that, and also meeting the Youth Centre in Strasbourg and the Children's Rights Division in Strasbourg. So we are on the case, as they say, and we want to make this a reality. Just to focus that down onto Jennifer's introductory memorandum, I do think that we have to incorporate something about health and something about youth participation in those SDGs in her paper. I'll stop there. There's a lot more I could say, but I will stop because other people will want to speak. Thank you. And thank you for coming.
Maybe we can invite Jennifer one day for a meeting, the Anna Lindh Foundation. Mm-hmm. And Anna Lindh Foundation, that is the superpower of young and women and working together. And Anna Lindh was the killed Swedish foreign minister, and her foundation is around the Mediterranean world. And there are partners in all member states of Anna Lindh, and that's especially the young people, or people who are still young, and women organization, and people who want to build bridges. Serhii.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this excellent opportunity to have an exchange with such a distinguished panel. I would like to use this opportunity straight away and address Mrs. Paish by asking if you're going to be at the General Assembly meeting next week in New York, because I'm going there as a representative of the Council of Europe of Parliamentary Assembly on the high-level meeting on tuberculosis, and if you can meet maybe on a separate occasion, it would be nice. One of the topics which really concerns me, also as a member of the Subcommittee on Children, is the violence against children in armed conflicts. I know this is part of your mandate as well, in accordance to the UN resolution from 2001. And I wonder what you think of the efforts which currently are being done in that direction, particularly as far as Europe is concerned. There have been a number of resolutions adopted by this Assembly, which were effective to a less extent, because when we know who is behind many of these armed conflicts, which is a country, a state called Russia, which was so authoritarian regime, there is very little possibilities for the dialogue on the regional level. So I wonder whether you see this also a challenge in your work. Whether you have a good relationships with the Russian authorities and to address all these issues, whether it relates to Azerbaijan or Ukraine or Syria also, are they responsive? There is, to some extent, a possibility for dialogue at the level of our organization. There's regular meetings of the General Secretary, Mr. Jagland. I know the President of the Parliamentary Assembly is going to St. Petersburg next week. We have a special ad hoc committee where we have regular exchange. But so far there has been a limited response, particularly on the issues of human rights, protection, the protection of some indigenous nations in, for example, after the annexation of Crimea, like the Crimean Tatars. There are a lot of political prisoners in Russia. I think there is still a room for some progress if you take certain international agreements like the Oslo Declaration on safe schools, for example, which is Russia is not a signatory. Perhaps that, you know, at least moving like with these small steps forward and securing certain areas related to children and trying to protect them from certain forms of violence by using these international instruments, taking it maybe to a level of United Nations. Maybe it's also a good idea to initiate a special high-level meeting on children rights in armed conflicts, for example. There are so many of them across the globe right now. And just dedicate a special meeting just to this one specific topic. I think that would be also one of the ideas. But these are the kind of ideas I would like to discuss with you maybe next week if you meet there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now I give the floor to the former chair of this committee, Stella.
Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for excellent presentations. I'm going to touch on again on the subject of violence against children. And as you have said, the campaign of 1 in 5 in the Council, in the Parliamentary Assembly, the Council of Europe, I think was one of the most successful campaigns we have in terms of joining across our member states the voice against sexual abuse of children. And I think it was extremely, extremely successful in achieving that. I am very concerned about the forms of violence which seem to pass under the radar. And I'm talking about the everyday psychological violence that children suffer in their families and the misconception that corporal punishment is still acceptable in many of our member states. And I wanted to hear your comments on that and the possibility of ourselves as a parliamentary assembly on moving into those kind of areas which are less obvious but equally traumatic for children. Thank you.
Now, for short comments, the floor first to Mrs. Benning, then to Mr. Amraoui, and at least to Mrs. McCarthy. Then I come back to the podium, to our guests, and at the end and the final wording are you, Jennifer, okay? Okay, Mrs. Benning, please.
Ja, ich bin glücklich, dass wir diesen Bericht hier heute im Ausschuss haben. Das ist wirklich sehr wegweisend. Ich finde das sehr gut, dass wir über die SDGs sprechen. Wir können das viel häufiger machen. Ich möchte einfach berichten, dass wir in Deutschland eine nationale Strategie haben zur Nachhaltigkeit. Die wird intern alle 2 Jahre besprochen. Die wird intern alle 2 Jahre revidiert an Indikatoren. Und wir stellen uns international einer Peer Review und haben Anfang diesen Jahres da auch einen internationalen Bericht zu bekommen. Und ich denke, das ist anregend für den Europarat, eben auch für die anderen Länder, in die Richtung hin zu arbeiten. Denn es sind ja 17 Ziele mit 69 Unterzielen, die eigentlich erfüllt werden. Da geht es natürlich auch um Kinder. Ich persönlich bin Mitglied in einem parlamentarischen Beirat der Bundesregierung zu Nachhaltigkeitszielen und wir betrachten alle Gesetze, die eingebracht werden, unter diesen Gesichtspunkten. Alle SDGs werden geprüft und wir haben ja auch heute noch einen Vortrag mit meinem Thema der nachhaltigen Stadtentwicklung. Das ist der SDG Punkt 11. Und vielleicht könnten wir anregen, auch hier in diesem Ausschuss immer wieder die Ziele zu benennen, unter denen dann schlussendlich unsere Anträge laufen. Denn alles, was wir im Europarat machen, sollte ja auch zur Nachhaltigkeit beitragen.
Danke sehr. Das begrüße ich sehr. Monsieur Amraoui.
Ja, ist gut. Merci, Monsieur le Président. Les violences envers les enfants, bien sûr, avec plusieurs formes, prennent plusieurs visages. Et ce phénomène n'épargne aucune région, aucune ethnie et aucun pays. Et malheureusement, peu visible parce que des fois culturellement accepté. Le Maroc, j'ai dit hier, a ratifié un certain nombre de conventions européennes. Et je voudrais aussi signaler cette semaine la publication d'un rapport du Centre des objectifs de développement durable pour l'Afrique, basé à Kigali, et qui mesure les indicateurs et tableaux de bord des ODD en Afrique, et qui indique que le Maroc arrive en tête au niveau du continent africain, avec 66% des objectifs mondiaux, 12 ans avant le... Et ceci grâce aussi à la politique de voisinage de l'Europe, d'où l'importance de développer encore plus ces politiques de voisinage. Merci.
And that's right. There was a decision some years ago by your king to take part in the action against climate change, and he decided that you have a tramway system in Rabat, and now it's the youngest tramway system in the main capital, and I think you fight really successfully against greenhouse gases. Now we go to the Green Island of Ireland, please.
I'm actually UK, but my father was from Ireland, so I guess I tick that box as well. Just got a very Irish name. Yeah, I've got a foot in both camps. So in the UK government has actually come in for quite a lot of criticism in terms of its approach to the SDGs. In that, to start with, at least it seemed to see it very much as a continuation of the Millennium Development Goals, and so it was something that our Department for International Development would do to other countries, so to do in Africa. So meeting the goal on food poverty, for example, was all about raising living standards in sub-Saharan Africa, as opposed to dealing with the huge numbers of people in food poverty in our country. So I just wondered, I think they're getting a little bit better, but certainly from what I've seen of other countries, they're far more advanced in having a strategy that relates to domestic policy. And I just wondered where the panel saw that balance, to what extent the SDG should continue to be a driver of development policies as opposed to domestic policies.
Thank you very much. Now I'm looking to the podium. Who wants to take the floor? Yes, please start.
Bom, permitam-me então que deixe ficar algumas contribuições para as questões que foram formuladas e para os comentários que foram feitos. Em primeiro lugar, eu gostava de dizer o seguinte: esta prioridade que aqui nos foi transmitida por parte da Sra. Representante Especial do Secretário-Geral das Nações Unidas, como a primeira das primeiras prioridades, é para nós muito importante. E no seguimento dessa definição prioritária, tendo em vista erradicar todas as formas de violência contra as crianças, e considerando uma das intervenções que referiu a importância do acesso à saúde como o foco da grande preocupação, saúde e acesso à escola, eu gostaria de lembrar uma das práticas que temos vindo a implementar aqui em Portugal e que poderia eventualmente ser uma prática a ser avaliada por parte do próprio Conselho da Europa como uma prática a transpor para outras realidades. Tem a ver com duas, uma experiência que se desenvolve depois de duas formas. Uma primeira experiência tem a ver com os cuidados de saúde domiciliários. É uma experiência desenvolvida tendo em vista garantir o acesso à saúde, nomeadamente aos mais frágeis, e entre aqueles que têm maiores fragilidades no acesso à saúde, nomeadamente por falta de recursos económicos e financeiros, por dificuldades de transporte e de mobilidade. Sabemos bem que esse é um problema grave em muitas das regiões que são objeto das preocupações da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa. Os cuidados de saúde domiciliários têm sido uma resposta muito positiva para as crianças, para os mais velhos e, muito particularmente, no âmbito da saúde materno-infantil, que sei que é uma preocupação do vosso trabalho. Quando digo cuidados de saúde domiciliários, tratam-se de equipas médicas e de enfermagem que, com viaturas próprias e adequadas, algumas dessas viaturas com equipamento de saúde, se deslocam para os territórios mais afastados das unidades hospitalares ou das unidades de saúde fixas, materialmente fixas. A segunda interpelação que nos foi feita tinha a ver com o seguinte: e como é que nós poderemos envolver mais os jovens no cumprimento e na integração nestes objetivos do desenvolvimento do milénio? Eu diria que não há uma política bem sucedida se não formos capazes de envolver os poderes que estão mais próximos das populações, os poderes locais e os poderes regionais. E, na relação com os poderes locais, o envolvimento e a integração das estruturas do movimento associativo, das organizações não-governamentais. E, dentro desse esforço de envolvimento das comunidades locais, para o qual é absolutamente indispensável o envolvimento dos poderes locais, razão pela qual há pouco, mais atrás, referi a importância de uma abordagem multinível, porque ela deve ser multinível para conceber, deve ser multinível para implementar e deve ser multinível para aplicar e para avaliar, para monitorizar os seus efeitos. E aqui os poderes locais são essenciais. São os poderes locais, as comunas, as autarquias, os poderes regionais, então, em colaboração com o movimento da sociedade civil, que pode mobilizar os jovens e trazer os jovens para esta causa. Gostaria, aliás, de lembrar que nos vossos documentos há uma referência aos 30 anos da Carta relativa aos poderes locais e regionais europeia, aliás, para a qual o Conselho da Europa deu um contributo decisivo. Foi o Conselho da Europa que esteve na origem do Comitê das Regiões, do Fórum dos Poderes Locais e Regionais Europeus. Julgo que nunca será demais sublinhar a importância dessas conquistas e revalorizá-las do ponto de vista da agenda política e do ponto de vista do envolvimento desses atores para trazer os jovens e também, permitam-me, para trazer maior participação das mulheres para a agenda, porque sabemos bem que em todas as sociedades há um relevo essencial desempenhado pelas mulheres na vida cívica e que nem sempre está refletido na vida política. E eu diria que estas duas dimensões, os jovens e as mulheres, são dimensões essenciais para o bom alcance dos objetivos.
For this anniversary, Luis Leite Ramos makes the resolution, yeah. And we will we have this resolution in October in the plenary session of the Council of Europe.
O Luís Ramos é um homem do desenvolvimento regional. Sabe bem a importância daquilo que estou a afirmar, porque há muito tempo que estuda o modo como se podem mobilizar as unidades num efeito capilar. Tem que ser um efeito de capilaridade. É esse efeito de capilaridade que faz com que as coisas aconteçam. Para concluir, queria referir o nosso compromisso, reiterar o nosso compromisso, tendo em vista participar ativamente na elaboração do relatório que foi referido, o relatório que incorpora o conjunto das iniciativas legislativas que cada Estado-membro tem vindo a desenvolver em prosseguimento das orientações estabelecidas nos Objetivos de Desenvolvimento Sustentável e na Agenda 2030, bem como, naturalmente, fazer chegar os resultados do relatório voluntário de avaliação que temos vindo a desenvolver. E felicito-vos pelo trabalho que todos, em conjunto, têm feito. Apenas uma nota final, que resulta de um diálogo que tive há pouco com o Sr. Deputado Leite Ramos, a importância de valorizarmos cada vez mais, ainda mais, os parlamentos nacionais, nomeadamente no âmbito das próprias Nações Unidas. Ou seja, o movimento das organizações não-governamentais são insubstituíveis. As organizações não-governamentais são insubstituíveis na, digamos, na pertença e no contributo que dão para o aperfeiçoamento do modelo, dos modelos de desenvolvimento, mas também a importância deste esforço que está a ser desenvolvido aqui, o esforço de envolvimento dos parlamentos nacionais, assim como o envolvimento dos poderes locais e dos poderes regionais, porque são eles que conseguem territorializar as opções de política e mexer com a vida das pessoas. Muito obrigado.
Obrigado. I'm absolutely sure that the house of democracy are the villages and the cities. And every action will be successful when villages very close to the citizen will take and do this action. And the national parliaments can make the framework. Yeah? Yes. But the reality, the really work in action, equally if it's for children, if it's for environment, is it for women, has to do and in the villages. Madame Reich.
Perfect. You seem like a Portuguese. Thank you so much, Mr. President, and many thanks to the members of the committee for your very important comments, and congratulations for some of the very important references that you have made, including in Morocco, to be at the top of the report for Africa, assessing progress in the Sustainable Development Agenda. I wanted to address four issues quickly. The first is to recall that there is a difference between the MDGs and the Sustainable Development Goals. Many, many could be highlighted. But certainly the fact that for the first time we are not only thinking about the South as needing help from the North, which is supposed to know the solutions for all problems, but that to ensure sustainability in the promotion of human development, all countries can do better. And in fact, in all countries, we have left many behind and have missed many opportunities is a big shift, a paradigm shift. But in addition, the recognition that the goals are in fact not to be seen in isolation. I want to illustrate with violence against children. If we do not protect children from violence, their health, and I go back to a very important point by Doreen a moment ago, the health of children, physical and mental, will be dramatically affected. And the truth is, society is very often not ready to address the trauma endured by children and to provide the quality services that are required. For instance, the community-based and the local-based services that we see mentioned just a moment ago. I'll give you one example. Tomorrow I'm going to address a conference in Paris about mental health of children, and looking at the data, it's so daunting to feel that around the world, the investment in mental health is less than $2 per person every year, and in developing world is 0.25% of a dollar. So there are so many things that we are missing, and the SDGs call on us to see the relationship between all these important areas so that by investing in positive action and promoting progress, everything can in a cascade benefit from this important action by countries. The second issue I wanted to mention is that, of course, when we looked at the MDGs, one big lesson we took was that all the countries which were affected by violence were lagging behind. They had higher rates of under 5 mortality, they had more children out of school, they had more children with health problems, and many of those children were dependent on welfare institutions. So clearly that was not the way. We now have an opportunity to change. But as we have heard, and Stella recalled it very strongly, there are many forms of violence that remain still very silent. Just think about what happens in the privacy of the home. You know, how do we monitor that? How do we empower parents to be the best parents and to ensure the affection nurturing environment that children need? And the fact that we have every 5 minutes a child dying as a result of violence is, of course, a wake-up call for all of us. But there are other forms. I mean, children tell us about what they suffer as a form of bullying or cyberbullying. Just to tell you, within a week or so, we are going to submit a report of the Secretary General on the topic, and so many countries are not addressing it seriously as it should. So just touching on corporal punishment, still in Europe, I believe it's only 32 members of the Council of Europe which have a comprehensive ban on all forms of violence, including corporal punishment against children. Certainly the Parliamentary Assembly can help us, relaunching the anti-smacking campaign that had been presented a few years ago in the Council to encourage countries to address this topic and to provide the best positive parenting initiatives to support parents in this endeavor. The second issue, when we say the agenda is relevant for all countries in the north and in the south, it's because a lot remains to be done, but it is because there is a lot to learn from each other. And, you know, I travel a lot around the world, everywhere around the world, and I'm very encouraged by what I see happening in Europe. Very great strategies on violence against children, budget allocation, good quality services. But I am equally encouraged by what I see in Bhutan, in very remote areas, or in Ecuador, or in Peru, or whatever country you may think of. So, and the opportunity to have a platform where we can go faster, not repeating the errors and the missed action and ill action, is of course a great promise that we can go accelerate progress in the implementation of the Sustainable Development Agenda. And this is why we believe the national review reports to be submitted to the High Level Political Forum can be a self-critical opportunity. And I'm very happy that the UK is going to report next year. So we have an opportunity to influence this. Third point, as Doreen said, it's very important to ensure the participation and empowerment of children. This is not just to be tokenistic. First, because they are citizens like everybody else, of course. But the second one is that the agenda itself recognizes two important things. The first one is that it recalls the responsibility of states of investing in children. So it's a way of showing that countries are investing. And secondly, that children need to be envisaged as agents of change, as partners in the progress we want to achieve. And I'm sure that the report led by Madame Temahman no doubt will capture that richness that children can provide. And they are ready to support us. And if there is a way of organizing, with the support, as some of you have said, a discussion with young people supported by the Parliamentary Assembly, and those voices can be brought to next year's General Assembly of the United Nations in New York. It can have a huge impact on heads of state and government. So this may be an idea to continue to nurture. The final point is on children in armed conflict, and I'm very thankful for the reference that was made. Of course, children in armed conflict are covered by the Sustainable Development Agenda. Child soldiers in particular are addressed under Goal 8. But in addition, of course, this is a priority for the United Nations as a whole. For my mandate, no doubt, because violence happens also in conflict. But there is another special representative on children in armed conflict specifically, and if you're coming to New York, of course, we will be very happy to meet with you, both of us, and to support you in your endeavor. But what I want to say is two things. There is an annual debate in the General Assembly, in the Human Rights Council and in the Security Council on violence against children and on children in armed conflict, so contributions can be made to those debates. And secondly, I just want to remind you all that when we look at the data around the world, violence against children in 90% of the cases doesn't happen in conflict. It happens in the privacy of the home. It happens behind the curtain of silence of institutions that are designed to care and protect children. And therefore, we need to really look behind what is the apparent. I'm not saying it's not important. It's very important. And children should not be instrumentalized or manipulated. But there is a lot more that we cannot neglect, and I'm sure you will help us do that. Thank you again.
Thank you, too. I don't want to be impolite, but I have also to think that we have one hearing more, and it is in respect of the experts which arrived. Please, Ambassador, we have today in the evening the chance to continue these talks. And I know Mrs. de Timmerman and I, for example, we will be in the North House Center in the evening. And now I give the floor, back to Madame de Timmerman, but she must promise me only three sentences or four that we can close now this hearing. And I thank you all for this lively and wonderful debate, and I thank to these fantastic experts. We are all very impressed, and thank you. And you made this debate really on a high-level debate. Jennifer, please take the floor.
Je vous remercie, Monsieur le Président. Je vais essayer de faire bref. Je vais donc d'abord remercier Monsieur José Luis Carneiro, Madame Maria Santos Pais et Monsieur José Rui Carocho pour leurs interventions. Dire que je suis ravie que vous vous proposiez de contribuer à ce rapport par vos apports personnels. J'ai commencé à éplucher les revues nationales volontaires qui ont été remises lors du FPE. HN, mais j'ai pas terminé, j'avoue. Mais je serais ravie d'entendre ce que vous faites au Portugal. Je voudrais juste souligner deux choses. Alors en France, on est en train autour de notre commissaire général au développement durable, Laurence Monnier-Smith, de se lancer dans l'élaboration d'une feuille de route aux objectifs de développement durable. Et jusqu'à présent, j'étais la seule parlementaire à en faire partie, et j'essaye de faire venir mes collègues. C'est pour ça que le 29 octobre, j'organise à l'Assemblée nationale un événement à destination de mes collègues députés pour leur faire, les inciter à s'emparer du sujet des objectifs de développement durable. Si jamais certains parmi vous sont sur Paris cette date-là, n'hésitez pas à venir à vous joindre à nous pour témoigner de ce que vous faites, vous, dans vos états respectifs. Après, je voulais rebondir sur les remarques à la fois de la baronne Massé et du secrétaire d'État José Luis Carneiro, à la fois sur les enfants et les collectivités. Alors, moi, à l'Assemblée nationale, mon deuxième cheval de bataille, si je puis dire, c'est justement l'éducation au développement durable. Je travaille avec la secrétaire d'État, Brune Poirson, justement à essayer de sensibiliser notre ministre de l'Éducation. Et sur les collectivités, la semaine dernière, j'étais à un événement organisé à Paris sur le forum politique de haut niveau, et j'ai parlé justement des rôles des collectivités. Donc c'est des sujets qui m'intéressent, mais la proposition de résolution a fait du titre du rapport la limiter, il me semble, au rôle des parlements et des États membres. Donc je suis tout à fait disposée à étendre mon propos au rôle des enfants, à l'éducation, au développement durable et aux collectivités, au rôle qu'on peut apporter. Et dans ce cas-là, il faudrait peut-être qu'on modifie le titre et qu'on intègre cela. Voilà, mais effectivement, ce sont des sujets pour moi importants. Merci à tous de vos contributions et n'hésitez pas à me faire part de ce qui se fait dans vos états. Merci.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. We are sure this report is in good hands. In your hands are good hands. And now I have to ask if all agree that we can the introductory memorandum declassify. Yes, we can, so we will note this in the minutes. The next, 1 minute, is the topic stress at work, and our rapporteur, Stefan Verkamer, is with us, and we have two experts, Mrs. Malgorzata Milcharek, Project Manager, Prevention and Research Unit of the European Agency of Safety and Health at Work in Bilbao, and also the second guest is Mrs. Julie Hassard. She is the Deputy Director of the Centre of Sustainable Working in the University of London and also an Assistant Professor of Occupational Health Psychology in the Nottingham University. But first, as always, I ask the rapporteur for a short introduction.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Chers collègues, en juin 2016, notre commission des questions sociales avait, à mon initiative, introduit une proposition de résolution concernant le stress au travail. Le stress sur le lieu de travail est le deuxième problème le plus courant en matière de sécurité et de santé au travail en Europe. Une étude mondiale de l'OIT sur le stress au travail démontre que les notions de stress professionnel et de risques psychologiques ne sont pas claires pour nombreuses personnes, alors que l'impact sur la santé des actifs peut être extrêmement grave. D'ailleurs, cette question est souvent peu connue et mal comprise des managers, et les services de médecine de travail ne mettent pas suffisamment l'accent sur les politiques de prévention. Le stress au travail apparaît lorsque les connaissances et la capacité d'un travailleur ou d'un groupe de travailleurs à faire face à une situation ne correspondent pas aux attentes de l'entreprise, l'évolution démographique, des innovations technologiques et les nouvelles formes d'organisation du travail ont débouché sur de nouvelles normes dans le monde du travail contemporain. L'emploi précaire est récurrent dans les sociétés frappées par la crise économique et la concurrence entre employés est en hausse. Le contexte d'incertitude et de pression crée ainsi un environnement propice au développement des symptômes de stress et en conséquence, il faudrait agir au niveau national et européen contre cet enjeu de santé publique qui a des effets néfastes sur la santé physique et mentale des travailleurs, qui pèse sur la performance et représente un coût économique énorme pour les entreprises. Je suis dès lors très content que l'Assemblée s'occupe de cette problématique et c'est un grand plaisir pour moi de vous présenter les deux experts qui sont avec nous aujourd'hui. Il s'agit de Madame Malgorzata Milcharek, chef de projet Unité de prévention et de recherche de l'Agence européenne pour la sécurité et la santé au travail du bureau à Bilbao. Et elle sera suivie par Madame Juliette Hazard, directrice adjointe du Centre pour une vie active durable de l'Université Birkbeck de Londres. Voilà, Monsieur le Président, comme introduction pour notre topic aujourd'hui.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you for your presentation. At the end, I will ask you for the revised introductory memorandum. And now, Mrs. Milcharek, the floor is yours.
be before you start. All men in the men's toilet, there is a key. They found a key. If somebody miss his keys, come to me. There you can have it.
Is it working?
Yes. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Małgorzata Milczarek, and I represent the European Agency for Safety and Health at Work. And let me start with saying thank you very much to the Council for this kind invitation. We are indeed very pleased to be able to share with us, with you, our experiences in the area of preventing stress and mental health at work. Let me start with a very short introduction of EU-OSHA, which is a European Union body responsible for collecting, analyzing, and disseminating information related to occupational safety and health. What's important to stress is that our governing board includes representatives of national governments, the European Commission, and also employers and worker representatives. It is within the EU-OSHA mission to address the most important occupational safety and health risks, and indeed risks to mental health, psychosocial risks, how we often call them, and stress at work are nowadays considered as one of the main challenges in occupational safety and health. In 2014-15, EU-OSHA organized a two-year campaign which was focusing on managing stress at work. This campaign was to raise awareness about the growing problem with stress, and there are current statistics that show that at any given time, 15% of working population is experiencing some kind of usually mild mental illness. Then we are focusing on the positive effects, trying rather to tell companies that it's important to protect mental health illness, but it's also that it pays off. There are many benefits associated with this. And also the campaign was looking to provide practical information. I won't be elaborating on the theories of on stress, and my colleague Julia will present later a little bit more information from the research point of view how we should understand stress. I just wanted to mention that this campaign was looking to protect mental health at work and physical health, because stress may also have very serious consequences for the physical health. So first, to take actions to prevent mental health problems, but also to promote well-being and good mental health, and to provide support to those who are already suffering. And while it's acknowledged that there are some external pressures at the workplaces, example could be, for example, could be in public sector or health sector with very serious budgetary limitations or standards that are imposed, and also acknowledging that some individual factors and our general life circumstances affect how we function at work, this campaign was focusing on the workplaces, was focusing on how the work is organized, how it is managed, and the social context of work. Those work circumstances can trigger work-related stress when the demands at work are excessive and workers simply don't have enough resources to cope with all of these demands, if it's job insecurity or harassment or any other problem. And stress is treated as an organizational issue and not individual problem or individual weakness. Indeed, our opinion poll that was carried out just before the campaign showed that generally across Europe, around 50% of workers said that stress is common or fairly common in the workplaces. And there were differences between countries, but the reporting level was high in all of them. Also, our establishment survey, which was carried out in 2014, was asking workplaces across Europe, in 36 European countries, what are the problems, what are the most important risks, and actually, on the top of all occupational safety and health risks, was a psychosocial problem, was dealing to deal with difficult customers, patients, and pupils, so which is called the third-party violence. Around 60% of establishments across Europe reported that it's a challenge for them. The second most important was time pressure, which was reported by 40% of establishments. We also asked if there are actions taken to prevent stress or to deal with violence or harassment at work. And we have observed a great variety across European countries and also across sectors and company sizes. The Nordic European countries and the United Kingdom and the Netherlands, but also Italy, were at the top of those countries when they were reporting that they've done quite a lot in terms of preventing stress, while other, especially in particular Eastern European countries or South European countries, this reporting level was much lower. And I don't have time to elaborate on this result. Just, if you are interested, they are all available from EUOSHA website. What's important to mention now that we need to explore these challenges, and EUOSHA in our subsequent research we are looking at what are the triggers, what are the drivers for these actions, and on the other hand what are the challenges and what are the obstacles. And some of the research I summarize on the slide, it shows that indeed at the country level, the national initiatives, and in particular this includes initiatives by the social partners, common and coordinated actions by the trade unions and employer associations, have positive effect, can actually trigger actions in the workplaces, and it's important, this political actions and actions by the social partners. But also, however, depending on the actions at the country level, the workplace culture and specific actions that are implemented at the workplace level, and especially management commitment to work to prevent work-related stress, and also worker representation, so giving workers opportunity to say and influence their working environment, were all important factors. And this can have important implications because it shows that the actions and support in terms of preventing stress at work must be at different levels. And it's not likely that if we only take actions at one level, it will have very wide positive effects. And if we are looking at the enterprises, it's also important to be aware of the challenges, because the best strategies or the best policies or regulations, the point in having all those strategies is to have the positive change in the workplaces. And what we observed across Europe, and especially in smaller companies, is that there is quite a lot of resistance to shape the work environment in a way that would be beneficial for workers' health. There is a strong tendency to individualize this problem, or to provide relaxation workshops, or invite workers to practice yoga, and these are all very good activities, and they certainly have benefits. But there are like palliative solutions, if you like. So if we want to efficiently address this problem, we need to shape work environment in a way that allows workers to respond to all the challenges, given all the emerging challenges related to digitalization or new forms of work, or the demand to be constantly available or be flexible. And we have to find a way to shape these conditions, and also for workers that are outside the, let's say, typical working arrangement. So there is a number of challenges in this topic. At the EU level, the topic is considered as of great importance, and they have been last year some policy initiatives that include problem of work-related stress and psychosocial risk that I will only mention the European Pillar of Social Rights that was signed in June last year that states very clearly that every worker has the right to health and safety working conditions. There is also quite a lot of focus on work-life balance in this strategic document. And also documents specifically focusing on occupational safety and health released in January last year specifies that stress at work is one of the biggest challenges and the actions are needed to face this challenge. And also there are a number of actions at the national level and new legislations being introduced, like for example in Sweden, and it will be important to explore these actions and to monitor the effectiveness of such initiative. To summarize, we can say that this importance of the topic and preventing mental health problems at work, it's widely acknowledged at the political level and in many workplaces too. However, there is still a gap between this acknowledgement and practical actions. There is a tendency to individualize the problem and the attitudes at the workplace level not always support preventive approach. And it's important to remember that there is a significant share of workplaces that are not willing to introduce any actions, and we need to find a way to reach them and convince them that addressing psychosocial risk and stress at work is not only to prevent harm, but also to actually boost their businesses. Well, there are many challenges, but I think it's a good moment to stop and invite Juliet.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Juliet Hazard is from the Birkbeck University of London and Centre for Sustainable Working. Can I give you now the floor, please?
Wonderful. Thank you very much to the Council for this wonderful opportunity to talk a little bit about, I guess some of the research that I've been involved in for about the last over 10 years now, looking at stress at work, understanding what it is, what its impact is at the individual, but also the organizational level, and beyond, and thinking then, what does action look like in this arena? So I'll just... there we go. Thank you very much. I hope that this presentation is very much sort of complementary to what we've just heard. My aim is really to, I suppose in a way, sort of taking a step back and looking at trying to summarize the evidence base in this area. So firstly, I wanted to talk about and just give an overview of, how common is work-related stress and looking at the picture in the UK. So in 2016 and 17, there were over 500,000 workers suffering from work-related stress, depression, and anxiety. And I think it's widely acknowledged within the UK context that these are likely a huge underestimate in terms of the prevalence of this problem. The Health and Safety Executive estimated that 12.5 million working days are lost due to work-related stress, depression, and anxiety. And the estimated economic cost to British society is well over 3.5 billion. Some recent research that myself and colleagues have done been looking at some of the economic evidence in this area, and it seems very, very clear that actually these economic estimates in terms of the burden to society are likely gross underestimations. So that's the picture in the UK. What does it look like in Europe? Well, nearly one in three of Europe's workers are affected by stress at work. So that's well over 40 million people. And the cost, or the estimated cost of work-related stress to the EU15 was estimated to be 20 billion. So a huge economic cost to society and at the national level. So what is work-related stress? It's the response people may have when presented with work demands and pressures on the one hand, and considerations around the knowledge and abilities in which to meet and cope effectively with those demands. So in some sense, in its basic form, it's an appraisal on what are the demands I'm facing in the workplace, and do I have the skills, the knowledge, the capabilities in which to tackle those demands. So this psychological state of work-related stress is accompanied by physical, psychological, and social complaints or dysfunctions. Within this field, when we think about what is work-related stress, it ultimately leads us to think about, well, what are the risks in terms of work-related stress? And so one of the key terms in this field is thinking about psychosocial hazards. These are defined as those aspects of work design and the organization and management of work and in their social and organizational context that have the potential for causing psychological, physical, or social harm. But what does that mean? So if we have an individual and we look at what I would refer to as their psychosocial working environment, we can look at a wide host of work characteristics or work and organizational factors that may define their working life. So some examples may include role clarity, relationships at work, so whether that's bullying, harassment, interactions with customers, pupils, etc. Thinking about the home-work interface, career development, organizational culture and functioning, their work environment and the availability and good quality access to equipment, job content, workload and pace, work schedule, control and autonomy in what we do and how we do it. So I think if we all reflect actually on our own working lives, for many of us, we can see how some of these work characteristics are very prominent, but we can also reflect of when they're poorly managed and poorly designed, what the implications of that can be to our health and well-being, of course, but also in terms of our performance and productivity. So when we have a situation where these working conditions are poorly managed and we have prolonged and excessive exposure to these risks, paired with the lack of resources, ability, knowledges, or skills to meet these challenges face on, we're in a very dangerous, precarious position in terms of experiencing work-related stress. But what's the impact of work-related stress? Well, the research is very clear, and I would say quite compelling, that the impact is quite significant at the individual level. And we can talk about this across a wide host of health indicators. Physical health, some examples being cardiovascular disease, hypertension, psychological health, depression, anxiety, and of course, health risk behaviors. Thinking about the propensity to do less exercise, eat more rich, unhealthy foods. So these are all very, very strongly associated to our experience of psychosocial risks, but in turn, work-related stress. But we can also look at what the impact is at the organizational level or the impact for employers. And we can talk about these as indicators in terms of increased absenteeism, increased presenteeism, intention to leave, increased tensions to retire early, decreased productivity and performance. So often we might talk about this as organizational health, where we know that stress has a very strong and significant impact there. But I think we can also extend that discussion to thinking about what the impact is at a societal level. So, of course, thinking about individuals who are physically and perhaps not very well, struggling with psychological health issues, thinking about performance and productivity issues, these ultimately will have both a direct and indirect impact at the society level. And there's a number of current reviews that myself and colleagues have just completed looking at specifically the economic impact to society at large due to stress, psychosocial aggression, and work-related violence. So I wanted to also pose the question, what does this mean for sustainable working lives? And we know that as we have an aging population, a workforce that by and large is decreasing, how do we keep people engaged in work in a healthy and supportive manner? And managing and preventing stress is ultimately at the forefront of achieving that goal, I would argue anyways. So how do we manage and prevent work-related stress? And I wanted to present here a framework, which ultimately in the field would be viewed as a best practice, which is looking at prevention on multiple levels. So in the first instance, we're looking at tertiary prevention. So this is remedial support, where our primary focus and initiatives will be around rehabilitation and return to work. Another level of prevention that we'll sort of look at is managing risk. So enhancing coping, mindfulness, stress management. And typically within the workplace, most of these initiatives, I would say, are very, very common. They're worker-directed. They're very much at the individual level. But at the heart of preventing work-related stress is thinking about prevention at the source. And this is ultimately, and I think builds off the previous presentation, well, is thinking about managing and cultivating working conditions. And at the heart of that are two key considerations. And first and foremost is the value and the importance of psychosocial risk management, so identifying psychosocial risks and thinking about developing tailored and responsive strategies in terms of managing and mitigating those risks. But it's also thinking about how we can enhance positive health resources within an organizational context. So on the one hand, it's about health protection, but it's also complemented by health promotion strategies. This multi-level approach in terms of intervention is ultimately underpinned by and influenced by the legal and policy context. So, of course, we have to think about these within its national remit. Best practice is ultimately viewed as adopting a comprehensive approach, which is utilizing all levels of intervention, from tertiary, secondary to primary, and at the policy level as well. So we want to ultimately cultivate a safety net so that we prevent sources of stress where we can. Where we can't, we're providing workers with active strategies to manage those risks. And for those that fall through the gaps, that we have the safety support and net in place to ensure that we're able to provide them with the support that they need. I also wanted to highlight the WHO Healthy Workplace Model, which is extending this idea in a slightly broader capacity. So what this model is highlighting is that to develop and cultivate healthy workplaces, of course, we need to think about managing physical risks, so thinking about the physical work environment, ensuring that it's safe. But we also need to think about managing the psychosocial work environment and mitigating those risks where possible. Ultimately, one of the key concepts or key characteristics of this model is really at the core, which is thinking about ethics and values. So what do we view as important in terms of workplace health? And thinking of how we engage leadership, managers, leaders of organizations in that process, and ultimately workers as well, who are both key players. So just to conclude, and I guess provide some final reflections, work-related stress is an organizational issue, and I think we have to move towards a very clear consensus that it is an organizational issue. We need a strong prevention focus, both at the policy and practice level. We need to encourage employers to, of course, meet minimum standards in terms of mitigating risks, but moreover, thinking of policies and initiatives on how we can encourage employers to move beyond minimum standards to think about how they can invest in the development and maintenance of healthy workplaces, and ultimately moving towards a proactive systems approach to workplace health management paired with strong and active social dialogue within and across key social partners. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation. When I'm in contact with people, I have always the feeling, the fears and the stress is untouchable. It's diffuse because they are always in stress that at the end of a working life, they fall in poorness because when they are retired, the money will not be enough, or that the kids cannot live from their work because they earn too less and it's not safety. Now, I'm looking around. Are there any comments? Any questions? Then I give the floor back to our rapporteur, Mr. Verkama.
Je voudrais remercier les deux experts pour leur contribution fort intéressante, comme vous dites, Monsieur le Président. Comme suggéré dans la proposition de résolution, le présent rapport a pour objet de sensibiliser les parlements et les gouvernements européenne au stress lié au travail en tant que problème majeur de santé publique, d'étudier les causes, les défis à relever et les réponses possibles et de recenser les domaines qui nécessitent une action législative ou politique propre à améliorer les conditions de travail psychosocial et le bien-être au travail en Europe dans les secteurs public et privé. Il importe de trouver les domaines où nous, les parlementaires nationaux, peuvent avoir une valeur ajoutée, où nous pouvons et devons lancer une action législative ou politique. Et il importe aussi de recenser de bonnes pratiques dans les États membres. Et comme j'indique dans la note introductive révisée, certains pays ont déjà mis en place leur propre politique, qui prennent la forme de lois, de lignes directrices ou de programmes gouvernementaux pour traiter la question du stress au travail et des risques psychologiques liés au travail. Et je cite quelques pays, mais je suis sûr que l'on trouvera encore d'autres bonnes pratiques. Et comme je l'ai dit dans ma introduction, le stress sur le lieu de travail est le deuxième problème le plus courant en matière de sécurité et de santé au travail en Europe. Il a un coût important pour les employés mêmes, nous l'avons vu dans les présentations, mais également un coût économique important pour toute la société. Et il importe dès lors de s'occuper de cette problématique et d'apporter des solutions et les contributions des experts donnent-nous des idées pour élaborer notre rapport.
I also want to add our thanks for your very, very interesting presentation. And I must say now, official, Mr. Verkama, in the bureau, the deadline for the preparation of this report was extended to the 13th of April next year. Only that you noticed that. You noticed that in your file you have the revised introductory memorandum now, which Mr. Verkama presented. And with the help of your input, we will expect a very interesting report next year in the Council of Europe, because you showed that there are different aspects we have to take note when we are speaking about stress at work and have to fight against. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Dear colleagues, Luis Leite Ramos invited us now for a lunch, and we follow those who are knows where we're in the same place like yesterday. We are at the place like yesterday. Thank you, Luis, for everything what you did, and thank you for the invitation now. Also, our experts are invited. Nobody knows these keys with wheels, Formula Uno, no.